Maybe some of you are new here this evening. It's good to have you. We're going away to camp next week, so maybe you're joining us. And it promises to be a very full and fun camp. It'll be very different for me. First time in 10 years not preaching. But I'm sure we'll all benefit from it greatly. And this evening, of course, we will be looking at Wait What before we get together after camp again for Get It. So if you're thinking of inviting some of your friends for that, that's great. Today we're going to concentrate on something in the Wait What series, which is religion. So of course, during the whole year, we're preaching through Hebrews. Maybe you're familiar with that. Maybe you've also come for the Get It's, where we especially want to make sure that we explain the gospel to our friends. Some of you may be here. Welcome. And at the same time, with Wait What, the goal is to look at maybe particular topics which have been inspired by the whole series in the sermon, in the books that we're preaching on at that particular time. And today, of course, is something which I hope you'll be open-minded about. Some of the things I'm going to say are obviously going to be a little bit disturbing to you, maybe very disturbing, since they involve something very personal to you, which is your religion. Some of you may actually be not particularly loyal to any religion, and it'll just be rather intellectually, of a matter of intellectual curiosity. But either way, I'm sure that it will and should affect us, and I want to assure you that I'm not speaking out of any particular mean-spiritedness. I'm trying my best to speak to you in a way that will actually help you and save you. And these things are obviously not easy if you are holding on to something which is not helping you, getting you to let go of it. It's going to be really difficult. Try pulling a toy out of a baby's hand, for instance. So I'm going to pray that we will be ready and open to listen to God and His speaking to us this evening. This is what we do when we open the scriptures. We're going to hear from Him and our lives will be changed. But I hope that you yourself will be ready to look through some of the things that we're going to be thinking about together, and you'll have a spirit of being willing to be changed. Let's pray together. We thank you, Father, for your word, for what you have to say to us, and everywhere that we've turned to in the scriptures as we look through Hebrews, we see the impact of what you're saying about your son with regards to how we ourselves treat you, and we have been treating him or maybe even ignoring him. We see the impact of what all this means in terms of our own seeking for salvation and hope and goodness outside of your son's teaching. And we're praying now, Lord, that if we, whether it is our friends or we ourselves, have been treating you in a way that's inconsistent with what you reveal of yourself in scriptures, we will have the courage by your spirit to change. That we will be confronted by this truth clearly, that today, as much as is possible, we'll be clear about the things which we have apparently committed to in our childhood religions, and the things which we must now turn our hearts and commitment to in the Bible's teaching of yourself and the truth about your son. This we pray in Jesus' name. Okay, like I said, I'm not sure whether you've been here before, but in any case, the Bible itself does have plenty to say about religion. It doesn't speak directly about other religions in the sense that if you open the pages of the scripture, you will not be finding a treatise on Hinduism or Buddhism or whatever. For one thing, after all, Hinduism and Buddhism is much older than, shall we say, Jesus Christ's New Testament Christianity. It's not necessarily older than Judaism, which forms the first part of the foundation for Christianity. So in that way, I think it's somewhat unjustified sometimes when people from those religions say, well, you know, we're older, so we're better. But it does cover plenty, including who God is. It covers who we are. It covers some really big issues, which in fact all religions are really trying to tackle, whether or not they do that consciously or not, whether they do that with a clear directive to their disciples or their followers. The reality is the Bible touches on all of it. And if you are here this evening, with the view that all religions are essentially the same, once you see that the different religions, and for now I accept that we're going to refer to Christianity as a religion. In the end, I'm going to show you that Christianity is not a religion. But if you are here with the view that the different religions essentially say the same thing, this point I've just raised up is already going to give you a problem. Because if they all are covering the same areas of who man is, who God is, what man must do, what God demands from us, how we fall short, for instance, then clearly there must really only be ultimately one religion if they're all exactly the same, covering the same area. But in fact, we have multiple religions, and it's quite difficult to say that they're all the same and they all do the same things when in fact they seem to be quite different, even at least from a superficial look. In fact, the New Testament itself addresses part of this, what I'm saying here, with a particular verse referring to gods and lords in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 5. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 5, we can see that although it refers there to the reality, maybe the existence of there being other gods, other lords, it does not do so in a positive way. So the New Testament, in fact, if you're going to start getting unhappy with what you have to hear today, you should start getting unhappy here. Because 1 Corinthians 8, verse 5 is already saying, these gods, these lords, are not God, the true God, and they are demonic, ultimately. So the first thing we have to note is that the New Testament is not neutral. The Bible is not neutral. God is not neutral. You are right to hear from us today that Christianity is opposed to other religions which would claim things which it itself would not be in agreement with. I don't want you to leave here neutral tonight. If you do that, I will have failed in my task. Please don't cause a riot or complain to the government that we are disruptive or anything like that. That will be quite not playing on a very level playing field and not being particularly nice. But I am saying to you, my aim is not simply to promote necessarily just a false harmony. My aim is obviously to promote an understanding based on a truth. And you yourself can challenge Christianity based on what you know to be true from your own Holy Scriptures, for instance. Or maybe you take that what we are saying here of Christianity is not fair to Christianity. Maybe you think that you understand the Scriptures differently. Well, sure, but if you look at the first verse we've got up there already, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 5, I think you'll see that it's quite clear. Whilst the Bible acknowledges that there are so-called other gods, they are not really God. And the New Testament exists in a world where people would worship many gods. But clearly by the time the apostles and the apostolic team, the missionary teams of Christianity worked on their mission fields, culture was changed for a long time. I mean, have you ever seen the temples that the Greeks had in our world coming to our world? Do you see an expansion of the polytheistic pantheon of gods in our world? Well, later I'll tell you how you actually do see it, but you don't see it now, do you? And that part of it is because Christianity actually wiped out many of these things. That is not actually particularly politically correct or to say the words wipe out, but Paul even uses the words to do spiritual battle when he speaks about religion, when he speaks about taking down these spiritual strongholds. He's speaking about the way in which we have to challenge these worldviews, because in fact there is one worldview that is correct and true and based on reality and revelation, which is Jesus's. So what we have to examine today in terms of a couple of us selected today will be not in order to agree with them ultimately, but to in order to understand them so that we can see in the way in which Jesus Christ saves, and therefore religion cannot ultimately coexist, and religion does not in fact save. This is something which I think you knew before you came. That's obviously on the title. When you came, I'm sure you must have seen the whole thing advertised on Facebook, social media. So as we go through this brief outline, I want to offer to you my apologies if you are a Hindu or Buddhist, a Muslim. I understand that I won't be doing perfect justice to it. But in essence, when we go through these simple points or the brief outline, we will be covering what they purport to be about, what the general landscape is, what the concerns are, and how the solution will come through this particular worldview or this particular approach. I won't be going through it in the way that is deeply personal for you. There will be a side of religion for all of us, which is ultimately belong to our childhood, our memories, our feelings. These are intensely personal. Why are you perhaps so enamored or so loyal to your Buddhism or maybe to Islam? And the answer is at least in part cultural and familial. Why is an Italian a Roman Catholic, even though he may not always agree with the Pope? And that would seem like a contradiction in terms. But the answer is because to be Italian is to be Catholic. I won't be going into a deep outline of those things. I can't explain what it means to be Italian and Roman Catholic, but I think it's a fair outline, even though it's brief. So emphasis on the brief. And in terms of the approaches, I think we can categorize, along with Dr. Jarabray, three general approaches to the way in which humankind has asked the question of who is God and who am I, or maybe not God, but in the end, who am I in this world and how do I find salvation, if there is such a thing in that particular religion. The three approaches would be the religions of fate. I think you understand what fate is. And the second one would be the religions of self-realization. And the third one would be religions of law. So that's pretty much in your outline. I hope you're going to be fine with that. And we're going to start, therefore, in terms of religions of fate with Chinese religion. I can see quite a few of us, maybe most of us, are Chinese religion, ex-Chinese religion people, maybe about 1,000 years ago at least or more. And even up to now, I'm sure that as your families here have migrated from Chinese religion, there is still a vestige of it. Maybe once in a while when you go to your grandparents' place, and maybe even just in terms of the attitude or the culture. So why am I picking this particular one? Is it because we're all Chinese here? Well, you'll see that, in fact, as we build up into the final run in Islam and then later Christianity, this provides us, in terms of the way I've constructed it, this approach provides us with a way in which we can see each concept briefly and we can layer it on upon each other so that ultimately what we see is a worldview, a consistency across all religions, which then will present us with Christianity in its particular uniqueness and its difference. I'm not trying to sell Christianity as just better. I'm actually trying to work through what it is about Christianity that actually answers the questions, the problems, and therefore is a better solution than the things we're going to have a quick view of here this evening. So let's start with the religion of fate, which I pick in this case to be Chinese religion. Now, in Chinese religion, we have something of a mixed bag. That's true, because it is not as organized as some of the other ones we're going to be seeing. But even though it's a mixed bag, it does have a pretty overarching understanding of fate, of life being predetermined by something larger than it. In this case, obviously, an impersonal principle or universal and absolute rule of all things, including gods and men. This is generally the characteristic of religions of fate, where there is something above us all, in this case literally heaven, because in Chinese religion, the tian zu or heaven is what represents this mandate or this reality, this overarching universal absolute. And in general, religions of fate will revere this overarching universal absolute, this impersonal principle behind all of reality, which everyone from the lowest laborer, lowest farmer, all the way to the emperor, who is supposed to be the son of heaven, has to follow. And if he doesn't, then there will be a problem expressed through natural disasters and the like. In fact, even gods in the Chinese pantheon have to follow this, this larger reality. That's part of the construction of religions of fate. as opposed to what we'll see later with maybe religions of law, which tend to be a bit more theistic. So examples of this, in fact, can be found in ancient Greek religion. So Chinese religion, you'll find, is not unlike Greek pantheons of gods, where there's different gods, etc. But in this case, above all these gods is this Tian, this heavenly reality, this heavenly mandate. So underneath this is then an evolution of complex ethical and legal systems which depend in a general way on this mandate of heaven. But in practice, it really relies on particular lawgivers. So you'll have the emperor giving edicts to the people, but ultimately he will be guided, as much as it is said that these edicts have come from heaven, ultimately he will be guided, for instance, by, in terms of Taoism's founder, Lao Tzu, and also Confucius. These two developed at different times, but they provide the system of ethics and the code of conduct, and they too will be based ultimately on this assumption, or I suppose you would say this belief, that ultimately all that is under heaven has to follow this particular order. If we go into Confucianism, you may be able to start to relate to this a little bit better. My worry for you is that as we go through these systems or religions, some of you will be like, this is why I'm not a Buddhist or whatever. The problem there is that it doesn't help you then understand it in order to understand it. Okay, so some of you might be at this point a little bit, what's going on? I don't particularly care for this. But I would strongly encourage you not to be like this, because although I don't want you to believe in these things, obviously I am biased right now, I'll tell you straight up as a Christian, in order for you to understand it, you should really open your mind to it and think along with it. Otherwise, your brain will be resistant and you won't learn anything. So picture, if you can, a farmer or yourself, transport yourself to China and see the large expanse of fields before you in the mountain ranges. I know it's hard in KL. But I felt this when I landed in Fujian province, my, shall we say, ancestral home. First time in my life, I was sent there for work. Not to be a farmer, I was in marketing. But when I arrived then, the plane touched down in the airport, I had a very strong sense of being home. I mean, only 150 years ago, my great-grandfather left this province in order to make a new life in Malaysia. So I felt a strong sense of what it meant to be in that land, and definitely geography plays a part in the development of theology. But as I stood there looking at the paddy fields, I could imagine what it was like to be a farmer whose life depended on the earth producing and who feared natural disasters and who worried about whether the emperor was doing the right thing in his palace as, in a way, a priest of the people. And all this time, this blue dome capping all his thoughts. And it's easy to understand then why there's this sense of this somewhat impersonal, but this overall absolute reality determining all of life. In the same way that an American Indian would speak of God in the sky, or the same would be said for Pacific Islanders and others. So you can see how in that environment, coupled with the wars on the ground and the chaos, someone like Confucius, who lived around about 206 to 220 AD before Christ, you can imagine how he would have understood the need for harmony and order. And if you can, maybe you can flow a little bit more with your ancestral DNA. When I say harmony, I hope it's something that you're not just thinking is belonging to one Malaysia or Malaysian propaganda. But I hope it, a part of you, which is Chinese, I don't mean to exclude Indians, you'll have your time very soon. But I hope part of you is now beating with a sense of Chinese-ness, of the way tea leaves should fall in the glass of or a beautiful vase, etc. Anyway, that's my attempt to get you into the mood of it. In 6th century China, BC, it was going through severe social and political pressures that resulted in civil war. And you may have seen some of these scenes reimagined by directors like John Woo, etc., with the Battle of the Three Kingdoms, etc., starring people like Jet Li. But Confucius, therefore, in this kind of environment, called for a return to the practice of ethical and social principles that will produce order and harmony. And that harmony should be seen within the family, within society, within the nation at large. And so finally, during Han Dynasty, 206, around about that time, Confucianism then became the established social and religious philosophy of the state. Things like ancestor worship, therefore, which you would be, as many of you are Christians, you would be strongly objecting to. Maybe you even came to me before asking me, should I be part of this, praying with the joss sticks, etc. This would be part of this Confucian ethic and Confucian religion. And your parents may have caught you off guard by saying something like, this is not about praying to Akong. Akong is obviously dead. And you'd be like, it's not? Yes, well, obviously not. This is part of respecting your elders, keeping harmony in the family. Okay? Just do it. Okay? Get it done. And you might have thought, that is not what I thought this was. I guess I should do it. And then you came back here, and maybe your friends told you, you shouldn't have done that. It's a religion. So that may have confused you a little bit, and that is precisely the character which we see of Confucianism. On one hand, you don't have a full traditional religion with a theological framework of who God is. As we said, this is a religion of fate, where the larger absolute reality is an impersonal being, represented by Tian, heaven. And there is a temple dedicated to this reality in Beijing, in the Emperor's Palace. But there is, on the ground, an understanding of this mandate in forming daily life, including ancestral worship. So order within the family, within society, within the nation as a whole, is patterned after the way of heaven. And Confucius's views, therefore, about God may be unclear, but he spoke a lot about heaven. He was pretty explicit about it. Maybe somewhere else, lost to us, is some direct exposition of who or what heaven could be. But really, that would be too much to expect, since there is no real revelation in the way there was in the Judaistic religion or scriptures. But heaven is seen to be purposive in directing cosmic affairs. And I don't think it was simply just a political tool. At some level, maybe if you watch Apocalypto or the Mel Gibson production of the Mayan culture, which is somewhat accurate in some places, you can see that politics comes into religion. And there is naturally in royal mandates, or within the expectations of the elite for the lower levels of culture, there is a political purpose where heaven or something higher, a higher power, is invoked in order to get things done. But here, I think there is, in fact, maybe an interesting, maybe a slightly curious for us, but still a belief in heaven being purposive, in heaven being directive in the future of man, not as a personal being, but as a cosmic principle, which therefore also grounds all of moral order. So if you sin against your parents, you are sinning against heaven. And no one would ask, you mean you're sinning against the sky? Well, how's that even work? No one would have said that. Okay? As I said, please flow with it. So the universe has a moral character. If you can turn the universe, an impersonal thing, into, in a way, something which is personal and practical and meaningful, such that you would see the importance of it in terms of moral law, in social relationships, and even moral will of heaven, then I think you're starting to flow with a central concept in Confucian thought. Why must I marry this woman whom I don't actually like? Because my father is the head of the household, and it is the will of heaven, and I would not want to go against that. And if I do run away with this other girl, then I'm clearly sinning against heaven. And when my father is ashamed and has to bring me back, and the whole village or town speaks ill of my family, I'm rightly facing the prospect of having to atone for my sin. This is all possible within Confucian thought. Because in the end, Confucian understanding, undergirded or in a way overarched by this understanding of heaven in a real and absolute way, Confucian thought refers to a proper way of doing things, an appropriate way of doing things, including obviously rites and ceremonies, including interpersonal relationships in business or otherwise, including ideal standards of social and religious conduct. In a way, this is a little bit hard for you to start off with, but I think Confucianism is a good way to start with what we have to say. Because now you can see that there is a morality that is possible without really having a strong undergirding in the kind of theistic basis that you are used to. So in this church, of course, you've been taught that love of each other, your ethic of love, comes from a verticality where God is the one who commands that and shows that to you and enables that of you. So we love because God first loved us. We don't mean by that we are simply touched by an example. We actually mean an actual ontological or person or being change where God himself has transformed us by the cross. And we've seen something of that in the Hebrews scriptures. But we also mean that we can forgive one another, as the disciples' prayer leads us to do so, because God himself has first forgiven us. Because God himself has cleansed our conscience and also, therefore, left an example, a pattern for what the new humanity needs to be in his will. If we'd hide our hypocrisy, if we were to say that we love God, but then hated our brother. This is John's point in his letters. So you see, our Christian ethic, which maybe is why you're struggling with this, is naturally horizontal, naturally vertical in its horizontal character. Or it has a naturally vertical character in its horizontal dimension. You naturally are dependent on that. Otherwise, I think most of you would not bother even trying to love your neighbor. But you can see here in Confucianism, it's entirely possible, I say possible for now, to be horizontally concerned without really ultimately having a vertical. Of course, that vertical does lift up above the ground. It does go in the direction of the sky. But at a certain point, it stops in the sense that there is no real personal God demanding that action, character, conformity, or love. There is no ultimate being who owns you, who has created you, who asks for that. And so for you, even now, it's worth thinking about whether this is even possible. And if you are wondering that, then you're doing quite well. Because in fact, for centuries, this actually worked remarkably well. By the way, just in case you think this is irrelevant, Lee Kuan Yew was a huge Confucian thought guy. And please don't say, who's Lee Kuan Yew? This evening talk is getting harder by the minute. But just in case you thought, I don't care about that. I mean, like, my parents always talk about this kind of stuff. I just don't care. But Lee Kuan Yew was huge on Confucianism, and you can see why. There was a small little island that he had to get into order pretty quickly. There was a need to make sure the society was put into harmony and order. And he didn't particularly want to align himself, being a Cambridge scholar, with any particular god, certainly not the Christian one. And once you start seeing that, then you can see how Singapore manages to work. But at the same time, you have to ask the question of, does it really? And in fact, in China, for centuries, one scholar observes, this worked remarkably well. And I think the word remarkably is exactly what's remarkable. How did it work for so long? But eventually, it failed at some point because, as you would guess as a Christian, it failed to develop an inner spirituality by producing instead a pattern of outward conformity to a set of social norms. Because you can speak about heaven, but in the end, the reason why you and I, in this kind of culture, this kind of expectation, are speaking and behaving and thinking and doing what we are doing, even thinking and feeling a certain way, is simply because of societal expectation and a certain code of conduct which we've all subscribed to. It has currency, but that currency falls flat when it comes to my true feelings and who I am inside. Of course, in our culture, we've gone too far the other way, where I am the only currency that matters. But you can still see that there is a falling short of what really needs to be aligned with the will of God or heaven or whatever it may be, which is you, yourself. If society is going to change, if human beings are going to be better to each other, if religion actually can deliver its payload, then you actually have to be a different person. This is something we've had to see from Jeremiah 31, of course. So this is already starting to show us the way in which a religion can attempt to find a solution. You can admit that this is a man-made attempt. I don't think it's too rude to say that. If you're a Confucius, please don't burn me after this. That would not be Confucian ethic. So I think quite safe, right? But after all, my point simply comes from the fact that Confucius himself did not receive revelation as much as he quoted heaven, or quoted that this would be heaven's mandate. He did not necessarily receive revelation. He cannot say what Paul says in Galatians, which is, I received this not from man. He did, in fact, make it up. Yes, you would agree? And so therefore, that would classify it as religion. And in its attempt to create harmony, both between man and, shall we say, inverted commas, God, or man and his environment, in the attempt to find a salvation answer in the midst of wars in a country that so obviously deserved that harmony, as you look at the beautiful winding rivers across the fields and the quaint little villages, and then suddenly you see it torn apart by war. In that attempt to find self-salvation, this was the answer, but this was also its failure. So we now turn to another religion of fate, which is a slightly different take, but still in a way overlapping and related, Hinduism. So we've got Chinese religion, which is very practical. It's us in an invisible way conforming, like in a Chinese school. My daughter goes to a non-Chinese school, and she clearly shows what it's like to experience when every man does whatever he thinks. But Chinese schools are amazing places where people conform somehow. So I think Chinese religion is a good example of that approach, somehow that magically works, yes? Who here has been to a Chinese school and agrees there's a certain kind of invisible expectation and somehow people just behave? Yes, no, yes. How do you all do it? Confucianism. How do you know to just... I can feel it. When I go back to my Chinese roots, I just suddenly feel like I need to pour tea for older people. And at points, I'm not very Confucian. I say stuff to uncles and aunties, then my older sister is like... And she's been overseas more than I have, so I'm like, what's the Confucian thing? What's going on, man? These uncles and aunties live in Holland. Like, she's like, you don't talk like that to them. So I don't know how it is that we Chinese did this, but we did it. Okay, now we go to the more sophisticated form, or maybe you want to say the less sophisticated form. I guess it all depends on how you view it and wear it. But I hope those of you who raise your hands, you're now in comfortable territory, yes? You understand religion in the way that it works for a particular group of people. Please help the rest who didn't understand all that. Hinduism. Maybe some of you who are more inclined to systems, maybe this is something more up your alley. Because the closest thing we can find today to ancient Greek religion is Hinduism. I repeat, the closest thing we can find today to ancient Greek religion, Zeus, Diana, Artemis, is Greek religion. Now, if you didn't know that, I just want to maybe poke you a little bit, because it's part of learning to think along these lines. I want to poke you a little bit. Could it be perhaps that one of the reasons why you find that sentence unexpected is because you think Greek is white, and therefore, but Hinduism is black, and therefore, so how can the black and the white be together? That's like thinking, I don't know, some high-end dessert, Belgian chocolate with ice kacang, or, you know, you don't find it compatible. But see, that I think is already something you must put aside, put away, or kill when we think together about these things. It's not about what color these people were. In fact, you'll find that in a way, the Hindu mind is a lot more white than you think. Anyway, anthropologically speaking, they're really on the Caucasian side of things. Right? There are three major races, apparently, depending on how you read certain anthropologists, but there are Negroids, Africans. There are Mongolians, not Mongolians, or Mongoloids. They're all here Mongoloids. Okay, you Bidayos, Kenyan, Kadazans, please don't say, we are Bidayons. We're all the same. And then, of course, there are Caucasians. What are Indians? They're basically Caucasians. Caucasian, my white man? If you spend enough time in the sun, you'll become darker. Anyway, you're right, okay? Hindustani stars? Yes? They look white, right? Some of them are even blonde. Anyway, so get past this racially biased understanding of religion and just understand it all in terms of systems and patterns and what they're trying to achieve. So I repeat, the closest thing we can find today in a world where the Greek gods are dead, even Greeks don't worship Zeus anymore, but the closest thing we can find to ancient Greek religion is Hinduism. So if you read Percy Jackson and The Lightning Thief or whatever, sorry, I'm not very familiar with the series of books, and you're like, I want to get back to Poseidon, you've got to be a Hindu. Okay? Why you laugh? See, that racial bias is coming in a little bit again. I'm not happy about that. Because Hinduism is also polytheistic and in fact has roots to the Greco world. In fact, you can see that geographically it's tied together, and I still remember watching in Australia with a little bit surprise, not anymore, thankfully, how one particular region of India, a small part which is connected to the European world, still practices the rites of menstruation for women that is exactly the same as how they used to do in the Greek world 2,000 years ago. And they're Indians. Okay? So the ritual is exactly the same. They even chant, the priest chants the same Greek words, but they're connected, you see. So forget color. Hinduism is polytheistic in the same way. And that leads you to a very important point, which I'll hold off first. But this is an important place to start with. Hinduism is a family of diverse religious traditions that are the product of some 4,000 years of development. Here's another reason why it's not easy to speak to a Hindu about Christianity. You can ask Rakesh about this. He is kind of like our Hindu go-to guy in our church because his parents are pretty serious Hindus. Don't ask Adrian Miller because he's not actually Indian. I told you not to worry about color. It's all meaningless, Adrian. Adrian's actually a top fun Chinese guy who does not speak with a good Chinese accent, admittedly. And Jeremy Johnson only started learning Tamil to try to evangelize his friends. So Rajesh is the guy. And we all thought, Rajesh? Isn't he Chindian? You see? Okay. Rajesh speaks Cantonese, Mandarin. Yeah, that's right. So there is no single founder of Hinduism. It is very old. It's 4,000 years plus. It is as old, almost as old as the Greek counterpart. And it has no prescribed structure, ecclesiastical structure, and it has no carefully defined creed. Well, something as old as that, that's kind of normal. But it already says to you that Hinduism, therefore, is very Indian. that's kind of unfortunate in a way, because it gets in the way of understanding these things. But it does mean that, like Islam or many other religions, or Roman Catholicism with Italians or some Europeans, it does mean that it's quite difficult, actually, to speak to them of the alternatives, because in the same way that for Muslim, to be Muslim and Malay are almost the same thing, or to be Arab and Muslim are almost the same thing, whereas for Indo, it's different. To be Indo, you can be animistic as an Indo, look at Bali. But for many religions, it's also carefully tied together, culture and nationalism, that even for talking to them, it can get really complicated, because you might actually be talking about being Indian versus Chinese, which is what they're thinking you're offering when you say you want to be a Christian, versus actually talking about the theology of it. So it's worth remembering we are talking here about Hinduism, not about the Indian part of being Hindu. Do you understand what I'm trying to say here? And in a way, you need to reflect yourself about what's Christian, okay? If, for instance, you say, to be Christian is to listen to three-hour sermons. Well, that's not being Christian. That's just to be in CRC, okay? That's your problem. Don't bring that upon other people. So they don't have a carefully defined creed and no prescribed ecclesiastical structure. A Hindu, therefore, can actually believe in one God, many gods, or no God, and it's still Hinduism. Now, I will present to you a concept that you need to understand, as I'll explain it more later, but it's called a monistic understanding of the universe, where there is a bigger reality which we are all part of, including gods, which therefore supersedes any need to either have only one God or many gods or no God as the ultimate. So the no God is, in a way, it sounds just like non-religion to you, but that's why we started with Chinese religion, because once you can understand, you can have a religion without God, then later we'll see how Buddhism is a religion, and Hinduism here is still a religion without having God, depending on who it is. Because in monistic thinking, there is an ultimate, an ideal, an absolute that is bigger than even the gods. And this comes from a guy called Plato, a Greek guy called Plato. Ultimately, it comes from Platonic thought, where there is an ideal, an absolute that is larger than any other single incidence of reality. Now, the Chinese did it without Platonic thought. Again, we are incredibly practical, or shall we say the opposite, people. I guess I can't be so rude today. But on one hand, we seem very practical. On the other hand, we seem a little bit... I can't get myself to say it. So anyway, it's either we know what we're doing or we don't know what we're doing in the Chinese religion. I suppose that's up for question. But in Hinduism, it is grounded in... It's still short, I think, of ultimately having a personal being who is God, but as we'll see, that also comes up later. But in Hinduism, this monistic reality frames the understanding of Hinduism. So, according to Doctrine of Reincarnation, and I have a slide here for you so you can read it together with me, it's from the ESV Study Bible, which is why you pay for this Bible, so you can read some of the notes at the back. According to Doctrine of Reincarnation, persons are continually being reborn as the Atman, the soul, passes from one life to another. A person's present life is one in an unimaginably long series of past and future lives. Rebirths are regulated by karma, which is a metaphysical principle that determines current and future states on the basis of past actions and dispositions. And then you have a repeated cycle of birth, death, and rebirth, which is samsara, which sounds to some of you a bit like samsara, I suppose, which is suffering, which may be the case, I'm not sure. But many Malay words are actually from Tamil anyway. And the traditional soteriological goal, or the salvific goal of Hinduism, is moksha, or liberation from rebirths through breaking the causal conditions of karma. So we have this ultimate reality overarching the Hindu pantheon of gods or thoughts or the Hindu, even slightly atheistic tendencies within Hinduism. But functionally, at the ground level, what you have working there is the doctrine of reincarnation, of persons being reborn, of persons going through a wandering, where there is a need to break free from this in terms of what's called a liberation, a moksha. Now, there are traditionally three ways to attain this, and you can imagine how you will want to, because if you're constantly being reborn and reborn and reborn, a never-ending cycle of pain and happiness and a bit of happiness and life and then more pain and on and on and on, in the end, you'd want to be free. So there are three ways to attain moksha. One, there are three ways to attain moksha. Is it not there? One, the way of right action, which involves living in accordance with one's duty as determined by your gender, by your caste, and by your stage in life. So in terms of caste, Hindus are divided into four major castes, okay? And there are, in fact, hundreds of smaller subdivisions within the castes. But right at the top is the Brahmins, teachers and priests. That's me, okay? I'm both a teacher and a priest, so yeah. And then it's followed by a second level, the Kshatriyas, who are rulers and warriors. You can see how even kings come below teachers and priests. I like this society. It's very well thought out. And then you have the merchants. Okay, this is a bit of a problem for me because I'm also from a merchant class. But Vaishyas are merchants or craftsmen. And then you have Sudras, who are laborers and servants. And both Vaishyas and Sudras, merchants, laborers, form the two lower castes. The top, you have priest teachers, and you have warriors, rulers. And the bottom half, you have merchants and laborers. There's one more class, which is unclean. They would be the unclean or untouchable caste, now sadly referred to as the oppressed ones, Dalits. But just to point to some contemporary realities, I was watching a documentary of Indians in Dubai. These are all executives. And they were saying that, you know, when they were in Delhi or Mumbai or whatever, they would have been concerned about hanging out with people from a different caste, clearly. But in Dubai, in an expatriate community, they couldn't care less. Now, I don't know how true this is in terms of if one of these guys in this golf club, if their daughter was to date this other person who's an executive in the same company, but that person is from a lower caste, I don't know whether or not it would ensue in harmony or fight. But it does show you that some of these theological views are really tied to the culture in which you grew up in. That's the real challenge here, isn't it? I mean, how much of this is actually rooted in something much larger, something more integral to their system of thought, and how much of it is simply just a cultural artifact? Christianity has some of this same problem as well. But anyway, you have to, if you want to attain moksha, at least the first means or ways is to be conducting right action, to be dutiful, in a way that's similar to what Confucius would have thought of in terms of society and harmony as well. But thankfully, in his case, there was no castes. But you know, we all know, those of us here who are familiar enough with Chinese culture, that there may not be a formal system of caste, but your parents most definitely had something of an understanding of who you should probably marry and who you should probably not marry. So in the end, human nature is roughly the same across the world. And the second way to liberation is that of knowledge. A central question in the Vedas was the question of who you are in relation to the Brahman. And the Brahman is possibly this ultimate being that if you can identify with, connect with, find union with, then you will find release. But who is this Brahman? And in Chandogya Upanishad, in chapter 6, the answer seems to be you are the Brahman. So as we say, we don't have a set of creeds and we don't necessarily have just one set text. Obviously, it's a very old understanding of religion and system. But what we do have is one text that seems to say that ultimately you are the Brahman. And I think that is an important thing to hold on to, because it does give us an insight into what we see of all these religions, that in the end, salvation is dependent on you. What breaks the cycle of births, of rebirths, is therefore, in a second way, as you can see in terms of liberating knowledge being the means, what breaks the cycle of birth and rebirth is the existential realization of your essential identity with Brahman. In other words, it's to be God, if you can call Brahman such a thing. Remember, there is no such thing as really God in this monistic framework. There is just an ultimate bigger ideal that's bigger than all of us, an absolute reality that even the gods are part of. But the way, therefore, to be free of this endless cycle of birth, rebirth, is to be connected and to be united to that essential identity of being that ultimate. And later you see Siddhartha Gautama doing something with this. And the third way is the way of devotion, bhakti, which is how you get the word bhakti in Malay, I suppose. Bhakti, of course, means love, reverence, and adoration. In this case, for a particular deity. And this morning, I already let the cat out of the bag. Next year, when we get back to movie nights, this year the movie night will be different because we're celebrating camp in a different fashion, tent here and all. But every year, if you haven't been to camp before, we have a special movie night, which as a church, just like our thought board back there, we like to be a church that thinks about our culture, thinks about who we are. And so as we study theology, study the Bible, we watch a movie, and they've all been very thought-provoking. I'm going to tell you what movie is next year. So I might change my mind, okay? So maybe you'll still be like, oh, Pastor might change his mind. But you can go watch this movie right after this. And if you see it at camp again, just watch it a second time. But Amir Khan has a movie called PK. Anybody seen it? I guess you don't watch Amir Khan movies. My daughter's a huge fan. Latima has the same ears, actually. But Amir Khan's movie, he is looking for an answer from God. And what he does is he performs bhakti to a lot of gods. We're talking about, he does everything from one temple where he rolls, to pouring milk on the deity, to obviously bathing in the Ganges River, to climbing mountains, and so on and so forth. Just watching that for half an hour will give you a sense of bhakti as a third way. And it's open to members of any caste. And that way, it's really a quest for any human being, isn't it? No matter what your caste is, I know we would see the caste system as oppressive, and of course, on a social level, from a liberal point of view, it is oppressive. But once you see that there's a third way, which is to perform bhakti, and a second way, which is to have knowledge, which maybe is more limited to certain Brahmins, then you understand that within the three ways, it is simply a quest for human beings to find themselves. But who is this themselves? Well, if you can find yourself as the Brahman, then you'll be free. But bhakti means to adore, to love, to revere, to puja, to ritually worship Vishnu or Shiva or Krishna. Can you see now a certain pattern that helps you understand the mind of being a Hindu? And this will, of course, prove useful to you when you are speaking to Hindus. Assuming, of course, the person you're speaking to is actually Hindu and not just Indian. You understand the difference, right? In case you have trouble with this and you're still somewhat naive because you became Christian last night and you have the theological understanding of someone's only been a Christian for a few hours, I once met a Muslim, and this was me being naive, okay? So it just shows you how advanced you are compared to what I was in first year university. But I met this Muslim in first year university, and after talking, I realized he liked to eat pork. I was like, when have you eaten pork? He's like, all the time, man. Okay, what about like alcohol? You're not going to tell me that you drink that too? He's like, sure, man, you want a beer? So, of course, being a sheltered little boy living in Malacca, not being like you guys, sophisticated KL City urbanites, I did not grow up understanding how complex people are and how inconsistent they are. So I hope you don't think that way. I hope you understand Hinduism and Buddhism and religion. And more than anything, understand Christ. But you also understand that people are just, people are people. And people are sometimes more Indian than they are Hindu, even as they argue that they are Hindu. And sometimes people are more Malay than they are Muslim, even as they argue they cannot leave Islam. You have to get down to what really is going on. So today's talk is not simply about understanding Hinduism or Islam or anything. It is about understanding ultimately how we can teach and help people to know Jesus Christ for their salvation as they look for salvation themselves in their own ways. Okay, let's get back to Hinduism. Hinduism, as you can see, therefore, is theistic in its traditions, whilst at the same time being monistic, as I explained. So you have Vishnu, Shiva, Krishna. It's not the impersonal being of heaven that we see in Chinese religion in Confucianism. But in Hinduism, it is still monistic, so that ultimately, whether you are worshipping Vishnu or Shiva or Vishnu and Shiva or Vishnu and Shiva or Krishna or Vishnu and Shiva and Krishna, in the end, there is a monistic reality above all that. In a way, it reminds me of Ben Bridgerton's description of Greek life, where you wake up in the morning, go to farms, and along the way, as you walk through the streets of your city, you might encounter immediately a temple. Now, for you in a modern world where major religions dominate, in the same way that you have major franchises for food, right? Chicken, Texas Chicken, Kentucky Fried Chicken, now McDonald's, like that, done. Certain key players dominate. Well, the ancient world was not like that. And so, for you, if you walk past a small little temple that's not your god, you just keep walking. But the ancient Greek would not do that. He would look at it, immediately he'd try to make an offering. Okay, so the moment I did that, you thought, what, is he Indian? Again, he's white. But in the same way that your Indian counterparts would do it, he too would offer either flowers or some alms or maybe a small burnt offering or oil or fruit or whatever he could find, say a prayer, and move on. And as he moved on, he found another small temple. He would then pray that at that too. And if you were to see something like that here, done in our street, it looks like something like someone getting out, going to the Chinese temple, then after going to the Indian temple. And then there's one more, by the way. There's a tree where there's a small little shrine. They should also do that one. It's covering all bases because ultimately, what is undergirding or overarching your thinking in Hinduism is a monistic understanding of the world. It is the supreme ideal that you are dealing with. So most Hindus, in fact, accept the idea of Brahman as the supreme being and sustaining power of the cosmos. So when you say, who do you worship? Are you worshipping Shiva or Vishnu? The answer for a Hindu, really, if they understood what they're talking about, is really, I worship all of them. And they are all, should we say, facets or persons of this larger person. In fact, you too are God. You and I are God in Hinduism. But for you, from your theistic background in Christianity, when you hear that, you automatically think, what? That's blasphemy. I'm not God. But they don't mean God in the way that you quite mean God. They mean God in the Greek Platonic way, in the sense of an ideal. So Hinduism is both monistic and theistic. Central to Hinduism, in fact, is the idea that the religious ultimate can be understood and can be experienced in many different ways. This does not mean that the Hindu is irreligious or traitorous or adulterous or idolatrous. Of course, it means that ultimately in terms of Christian theism, the Christian framework, but in terms of understanding the way a Hindu feels or thinks about it, this is not the way he is thinking. he is really worshiping the Brahman. Okay? You now starting to get a sense of the monistic understanding of Hinduism and maybe even the Greek mindset behind this. Okay? So today, Hinduism is the closest thing we can find to ancient Greek religion. And therefore, this is the exciting part for you, I hope. It means that Hinduism is also open to all the objections that were leveled against Christian religion against Greek religion by the Christians. In fact, in the Greek world, prior to Christian theology, arguing against pagan Greek thinking in its monistic and a monistic framework and large pantheon of gods, the philosophers of the Greeks themselves were already questioning Greek thinking and Greek religion. So in Greek culture, you have, in a way, two ongoing aspects before Christianity came in. You have the so-called religious side, which is like Hinduism, many gods, with ultimately a monistic framework. But these gods don't seem to be giving clear answers and giving a clear framing of how life should be. You can see why the Chinese one is a bit cleaner and has certain advantages. Hinduism is a lot more varied and colorful. You can, again, I said, worship one God, no God, many gods, and it all is kind of supposed to just cohere. So on one side, you have the religious side, but then the philosophers look at that and said, this does not make sense. This does not seem to be giving us the ethical grounding and framework that we need as human beings. So these were non-Christian philosophers asking tough questions of their own religion. Some of them, of course, were persecuted and killed. People like Socrates were part of this. But the larger questions they asked did highlight the inconsistencies within such a system. In fact, it contributed to, ultimately, the downfall of Greek religion. And in a way that the Greek philosophy questioned the weaknesses of this monistic thought, and it's also its polytheistic content, in a way that the Greek philosophers questioned these things, the Christian theology that came in was able to provide the full package of answers from the theistic God who is in charge of this world, who can make sense for you why things happen in this world, and who has sent a savior so that you now have an ethical system that coheres with what God's will actually is. You don't have to worship many gods now to have multiple facets of the one God. You don't have to temba and stab at 100 different gods to try to get at one God. And you don't have to worship just one God thinking, I suppose I'm still worshipping Brahman, ultimately in one aspect, but then what if Shiva feels bad about me worshipping this aspect because I should worship the other aspect as well? And now in God, in the Christian God, you have the total package. And so it wasn't too long. Of course, it involves persecution and a lot of pain and hardship. But in the end, Christianity did wipe out the Greek world, and did wipe out the Greek gods. Now, if Hinduism today is the closest thing we can find to ancient Greek religion, then my question is really for you. My question for you is, have you been thinking that when you encounter a Hindu friend, and maybe some of you here are Hindus, when you encounter a Hindu friend or you speak to a Hindu friend, have you been thinking, here's an animal that I don't understand? I don't mean a person. I mean, here's something I don't understand because it is a different color from my mind, a different color from my race. It is Hindu. It is deepest, darkest India, with all its myriad of temples and saffron colors and smells. It is scary. I've been to India 3 times, by the way, so I understand what you're saying. But a lot of it's just, I think, a mild form of prejudice. You think you cannot understand it because it's strange and you only go to the mamak once in a while because you like the tea and you like the roti tissue, which is just a gimmick anyway. But have you been partly inside putting a barrier that's unnecessary? Because you don't seem to have that same barrier with Greek culture. In fact, maybe you should.
But at least be fair. If you're anti-Hindu in some sense, in terms of fear of the unknown, then you should be also anti-Greek. But I don't see you doing that. But if you see, in fact, that the apostolic Christian response to Greek culture was not to hunker down and to avoid conversation and dialogue and polemics. In fact, as you can see with Paul, he traveled the Mediterranean world, engaging with it, arguing it. Look at his sermon in Acts 17. He walked right into the heart of that so-called darkness. He walked right into the heart of their debating center and asked them to think about the claims of Jesus Christ over and above their many gods, including one that they did not actually know. Just think about the way Paul approached Greek understanding, the Greek monistic world, the Greek polytheistic world, which is no different from Hinduism in that sense, except for the color. And think about how, in under 1,000 years, all that then just died. And think about how you, as Christians, have had maybe a little bit less time, but in Asia, we have our own Greek world. Question is, what are you going to do about it? What have you been doing about it? When you see your matcha friends in college and at a workplace, do you just think, matcha, and then that's it? Do you just think, Indian, right? And then that's it. But it's right down to the kind of unhelpful Christian ignorance and maybe prejudice that says you don't want to really engage and think through these things. I know that maybe 5-6 times out of 10, every time you talk to an Indian dude or girl and you say, hey, you know, can I understand about Hinduism? Maybe the answer is going to be, I don't know anything. What do you tell me about Jesus? I rather don't know about Jesus. I also don't really want to be Hindu. Maybe some people answer that way, and if that happens, that's a good thing, right? But I don't think you can presume that, right? I don't think you can presume that someone is not going to care about Hinduism just because they're a modern Indian in KL. So if I can encourage you here strongly to see what was achieved by Christianity with Greek Hinduism, I'll put it that way for you, and to inspire you to yourself in your generation to take the challenge seriously of doing what has already been achieved. There is, in fact, nothing new under the sun. It's just in a different language. So you have to go and learn Tamil. What's so hard? In fact, if you can ask Joshua Johnson over there, Joshua Johnson once told me that Tamil is, in fact, quite easy to learn because it's alphabet-based. Some of you are like, no, after Chinese, never again. Because it's just all these drawings, then you have to memorize every word. It's so weird. Ting chong, ting chong, ting chong. So, jiang nan, bu yao la. But I think you are just biased against Tamil alphabets because they look squiggly and they look alien. But if you can get past the curly bits, you'll see that it's just another language. I mean, you don't feel that way about Korean, right? You're just going on about how King Joseon was just so fantastic in creating an alphabet that's exactly like your tongue and mouth. You're like, oh, the Koreans are so clever. Listen to some Bhangra music and change your mind, okay? I listen to K-pop and I listen to Indian music as well. Ask Ilona. Ilona will recommend some music to you. It's just fantastic sometimes. It's more powerful than K-pop. Okay, so again, to review very quickly, as we see in the Hindu world, none of the gods are really uniquely supreme and they're all part of a monistic framework. In fact, this is the appeal that we see that Christianity had over against Greek religion in the same way that it should have against Hinduism, which I've called upon you to try to make known to your friends. Why is it they're not giving up Hinduism? Well, the answer is because you're not telling them, because they don't understand what they face in this monistic framework where if you have no God who is ultimately uniquely supreme, then you can't really propitiate anyone. You can propitiate Shiva, but how do you know you're in connection ultimately to the great Brahman? He's an aspect of him, but ultimately, how can you yourself be that Brahman when you have no face to refer to, ultimately, when he is many-faced and one-faced and no-faced at the same time? Christianity has the answers. And if you say, my Hindu friend cannot give up Hinduism because they don't know what Hinduism is about, and they feel they can't give it up because they don't know what it's about, but they can't give it up, then educate them to be Hindu so that as I'm teaching you Hinduism right now, you start to realize, even if I was Indian, I don't think I'd be Hindu. Okay? Maybe you're thinking like that. If you're thinking like that, then that's good. Okay? So the final thing maybe I need to repeat from this morning is your response of flight instead of fight has been overall wrong. You think that the solution to evangelism of your friends who belong to different religions is to not talk about their religion, but to talk only about the goodness of Christianity. That's the standard Klang Valley Christian response. And it also comes out as don't talk bad about anyone. And don't ask sensitive questions like religion. In Malaysia, especially the political environment, the last 50 years, you have been taught and programmed not to engage. But that is not how we get to an understanding. That's like two people trying to play poker or bridge, or trying to discuss the merits of bridge versus poker, or Chow Tai Ti or whatever, or 21, without even understanding what cards each other has, or how the deck of cards has spades, clubs, diamonds, etc. We can't get anywhere without this conversation. I mean, too often, when Christians in Malaysia talk about dialogue and conversation, they're not really talking about understanding each other. They're just saying, let's just share whatever we think is good about each other and be nice and polite. But if you really understand Hinduism, I do not believe that you would choose it. If you really understood Islam, I do not believe that you would actually choose it. Maybe you still would, but at least you are doing it from a place of knowledge as opposed to just, I'm Malay, therefore I'm Muslim. I'm Indian, therefore I'm Hindu. I'm Chinese, therefore I'm Taoist. That doesn't make any sense at all for Christians who are clearly Chinese and not Taoist here. Do you understand what I'm saying? So as opposed to not talking about it, talk about it more. And there's nothing to fear in the content of Hinduism. It's not as if when you discuss Shiva, Vishnu, or Hinduism with your friends, it's not as if suddenly you will break out in Tamil and then you will marry an Indian person. I mean, what are you even worried about here? And then you will never come out of Hinduism and you'll have Hindu babies. I know I'm being a little bit rude here, but I'm just trying to uncover some of your deepest, darkest fears and secrets. Because I don't see you having a problem talking to a Greek Orthodox handsome Lang Zai guy who's touristing in Changkat Bukit Bintang. Oh, you're Greek? What's it to be like to be Greek? Well, firstly, we don't talk like that. I'm Greek, but I'm from the States. I'm in Stanford. Oh, okay. So do you worship Zeus? I don't see you having a problem talking to Greek people. But suddenly with Hindus, it's, oh, let's not talk about Shiva. Let's not talk about Hindraf, etc. Let's move on to another category of religion. I know I spent time on that, but that was also partly an exercise in freeing your mind, to not be afraid, to take down spiritual strongholds. So religions of self-realization, here, of course, we are going to deal with an internally generated opposition from Hinduism, which is Buddhism. So once we start understanding Chinese religion and one particular offering of a absolute impersonal reality with a moral law and a certain pattern of harmony, and another form, which is Hinduism, with, in a sense, a moral law, but more a seeking for self-salvation, then we can see we've got the ground ready for the ultimate expression of self-enlightenment, which is Buddhism. In a way, Hinduism sits in a bit of overlap. Can you see? In the three ways of moksha, there was a bit of the Chinese. At the same time, there's what will then become Buddhism. But Buddhism is the mokshas, in a way, on steroids, particularly with the way of knowledge and without any mention of caste whatsoever. So here is the so-called religion of self-awareness par excellence, Buddhism. It started as an internal opposition to Hinduism, and so it naturally carries some of Hindu DNA. In fact, it carries most of its presuppositions. And it also therefore carries Greek DNA. which then therefore carries my encouragement to you. Okay, you thought that it was about pastors, all about evangelizing Indians tonight, but 90% of all Chinese in Malaysia, or more likely, is Buddhist, or at least formally Buddhist. Even I put down Buddhist in my IC, right, in school. Mom, what am I? Put down Buddhist. So you just put down Buddhist, okay? So really, if you can, you got past the barrier just now of evangelizing a Hindu, now you English-speaking Chinese people, you are going to get past the barrier of evangelizing 他们讲华语的. Okay? Because there's an unspoken barrier, even in CRC, sadly, between us and Chinese people. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to be comfortable being in this kind of cross-cultural world. Maybe some of our Caucasian friends here won't understand what we're saying because they're like, but you're all Chinese, you're all yellow. It's not about color, okay? There are real barriers. We just don't cry over the same things. I remember talking to Eric Day once. He was like, don't ask me to do Chinese music for church, okay? We can't. I said, one day we have the Chinese congregation, we've got to play more Chinese-oriented music. He's like, no, okay? Their songs are all the same one, okay? Like Wang Jie, like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's always minor key. Then it's always like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you go to a cafe, you're like, did I hear this song again? No, it's a girl this time, but it's got the same melody. Wait a minute, this sounds like a song from the 1990s, okay? And I don't know whether that's even true anymore, but for instance, Jay Chou has been heavily criticized, or where he was heavily criticized when he first started singing because he didn't follow tonality. And for us, English-speaking, trained in Chinese people, like my daughter and I, we still can't get past the fact that we are hammered by our Chinese teachers, huh? Pinging, huh? Make sure you get the right sound, huh? Then suddenly Jay Chou singing all sorts of weird sounds, okay? 你知道吗? Goes like, 你知道吗? Like, that's not proper speaking. Well, it's singing, isn't it? But it's so weird. So there's all these barriers that we have, including when to cry in a movie. Now, I have these barriers with Malaysians, okay? When I watch Les Mis, I cry at certain points and people were laughing around me. That is highly disturbing. I felt like migrating in that instant. I felt alone. It took a lot from me not to get up and go like, what is wrong with you people? Okay? It's so hard. But there are barriers all over, even between us. But that's the point, right? Vertical. We evangelize not because we like. We evangelize because God deserves it. So the biggest barrier here is not really ultimately between us and our matcha friends. They might even be more open. They're always keen on dating some of you chicks. But the biggest barrier is really between us and our brothers and sisters who are from the same mothers in China, because we are trained differently. Everyone knows here the famous Jean, right? Is she just like that or is she just Chinese? Okay, Jean is a unique personality in our church who symbolizes this, perhaps. There is a certain Chinese mind that I can see my own children having from years and years of control and propaganda and training in Chinese schools. And of course, everyone knows there are Johor Chinese as well. Johor Chinese are a whole nother kettle of fish. Johor Chinese are really strange to KL Chinese people. And then there's Sabah and Sarawak Chinese as well. But Buddhism informs all of them in some way or form. And then, of course, there are also Confucian Taoist Chinese as well. So let's make sure that we understand if Buddhism is Greek ultimately in its origins, through borrowed DNA, then just as the apostolic work could deal and answer Greek problems, then so can we with Buddhism. You must be confidently engaging in Buddhism. So let's attack this. Buddhism is very close, in fact, to Neoplatonism. When I was first taught Buddhism in More Theological College, that's where I learned it, the only form I was in contact with before that was Pure Land Zen Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, because my tuition teacher was a Zen Pure Land Buddhist, so she taught me to chant, but she didn't teach me the theology. So the only time I really learned Buddhism properly under the guidance of someone who understood it was in college. And as he was explaining it to me, and at the same time I had philosophy classes for Plato, I began to understand that essentially the two are very similar, if not exactly the same. Because in the Neoplatonic thought, monistic conception, again, is the key idea. In fact, the biggest expression of this monistic conception in the Hindu one, you saw that the struggle was to find Brahman. But in Buddhism, it's expressed fully in Nirvana. Nirvana is what is bigger and more real, more absolute and more perfect than anything else. And Plato would have been happy because this is the ideal conception of the absolute. So Buddhism is essentially a non-theistic religion of contemplation in which the believer is expected to rise through different states of consciousness until finally reaching the desired goal of nirvana. So in a way, the Hindu soteriological goal of release from rebirth, you can see how it sets up Buddhism. It gets it ready for asking these questions. But the Hindu soteriological goal of release from rebirth is now release from the theistic way of puja, of bhakti, release from the duty of caste. You don't have to look for these methods anymore. You don't have to be caste-oriented. And you don't have to go to a temple, because really, the means of arriving at this liberation, this nirvana, this monistic reality, is focused really on knowledge, on self-understanding, on self-existential fulfillment. But there's a very disturbing heart to this, which I find it very hard to speak of. But anyway, Buddhists might say that it's not a religion, but the very fact that we've understood it in terms of its Hindu framing helps us see that, in fact, it is a religion. Do you see? So Buddhism might claim that it is a non-theistic self-awareness approach, but you can see how the primary questions that it answers, the foundation for its angst and its soul-searching, is really from Hinduism. You follow? So therefore, it is a religion developed from a religion, but a religion, of course, of not having a religion, in a way. So either way, it's a religion. In fact, this coheres very well with what Luther has always taught us. Regardless of how people think of themselves in worship, whether they worship or they don't worship, whether they worship one God, many gods, or no God, I worship no God, they would say. Or they may even worship the unknown God, Paul would say in Acts 17. In the end, all human beings worship. You can't get away from the theological reality that we are made in the image of God, and idolatry is the imaging of ourselves into a God, or into gods, or into a no God, or back into ourselves. You might image yourself in your Porsche, your Ferrari, your wife, your kids, your ballet classes, your results, your career, into Shiva, Vishnu, whoever it may be. But in the end, you are still theologically in a soul search. And this, at the end of the day, is the value of deeply understanding these things. Because no matter who you are talking to, whether they are Hindu Chindian, or where there are Wanjie singing Chinese guy from a Johor Chinese school who has pseudo-Buddhist tendencies, in the end, that is the bottom line. And they may express it different ways, and the conversation will have to, for a few hours to a few months to a few years, deal with these elements. But in the end, the core allows you to keep conversing, even though it seems that every time you talk, it's Shiva versus Christ, reincarnation versus resurrection, and so on and so forth. But the bottom, the core is still the same thing. So keep studying these religions and keep thinking from it, both within their framework and within the Christian framework. So Buddhists might say it's not a religion. They might evangelize you that way, and they might encourage you not to evangelize them that way. But in the end, it still requires a great deal of presuppositional belief. They might say it's a science of the mind, but you can see that in the end, it is looking for moksha in its own way. And it finds blissful release in a monistic conception of nirvana. And so, therefore, it does have a soteriological goal. Do not let your Buddhist friends go to nirvana, which doesn't exist. You have to understand, I'm doing this in a certain mode here, but every once in a while, I'll drop into my, obviously, my Christian pastor mode. But do not let your friends go into nirvana without them knowing what nirvana is. Because nirvana is, at the end of the day, suicide. Don't let your friends go there unless they want to. And even that, they shouldn't want to. But nirvana is a monistic absolute of no longer being conscious of yourself. And therefore, ultimately, it's suicide. Now, I'll get to that. But the heart of the teaching of Siddhartha Gautama, around about 563 BC, so you can see why it's predating Christ, and therefore people who are Buddhists are a little bit proud about this. But Buddha rejected... Buddha rejected contemporary Hindu views about the reality of an enduring self, the Atman, or the indestructible soul that passes from one life to another. Instead, he claimed that belief in a substantial self is actually mistaken, and that belief in self, you can see how, in a way, anti-self he is, belief in that self actually produces more of the conditions which make you believe that you exist and you are real in a way that produces more suffering. In a 12-fold causation wheel of life. So, instead of thinking that you are self, which his argument here is causing more pain, because the more you are you, which is not true, it's an illusion, then the more you will feel pain. Instead of thinking that way, what you should do is you should realize that you are simply an aggregate. It's called the five aggregates of your matter, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Now, it's pretty hard to get away from these things, of course, because after all, if I punch you, you immediately feel pain, right? And punches don't have to be good or bad. I can punch you and congratulate you, and there's a pain that it says, congratulations. And then I'll punch you again because I'm unhappy with you because you're bad parking, and that punch says, you're a numbskull or something like that. But how are you going to get away from that reality, in that friendship you have with me, in that parking that you just did, in the work that you just did, which is either failure or success? Well, Buddha's concern is that you do get away from that, because in the end, that will just produce more suffering. And so at death, what passes from this life to the next, he says, is not a soul, but simply the cumulative karmic effects of actions, which then produce in the next life a mistaken perception of an enduring person. So you got to get rid of this being you that keeps producing this cycle of rebirth, because it's just going to give you more pain. So how do you then not be you? By the way, you can already see, I would have problems in terms of the logic of this. If there is no real enduring self, then how can there be a karmic residue which then moves on into the next body or person? Although, I suppose the point here is not to be that self which keeps doing that. Anyway, how do we get released? The answer is we must arrive at nirvana, which is permanent, which is ultimately real, which is not heaven, but it is a state when all your desire, all your self, all your consciousness, all your matter, felt sensations, all that will then be eliminated. And since there is now an absence of yourself, there will therefore be an absence of suffering and therefore be a state of utter bliss. So he has taken, in a way, Platonic thinking, which he wasn't, I don't think, directly familiar with, and taken it to the next level of making it a full religion. My problem, though, and here I'm showing my ignorance as a non-Buddhist, my problem, though, is nirvana itself. How can it possibly be a state of bliss if, by definition, it's not a state of anything? I don't really know how it can. It's a lot like saying, this screw here is in a state of bliss. See, it's not particularly happy, but it's not particularly unhappy either, and so it's in nirvana. But if you say to me, well, it's an inanimate object. Well, Buddha thinks that if you are an aggregate of matter, of feeling, You are an aggregate of sensation, of pain, etc. Then you're going to have a problem. Well, then what is the difference between this ultimate state of nirvana, this not being the five aggregates? What's the difference between being that and being me in nirvana? I mean, how am I different from an inanimate object ultimately? If you think about it, then where this screw is actually in a state of nirvana. And it would look something like this, right? Now, does that look happy to you? Because nirvana is supposed to be bliss, but do I look happy to you? So if you say to me, smile, Robin, I'm like, okay, I hear that all the time. So, well, that's a problem. Because smiling is part of your desire. So then what do? The opposite? But that's also a problem because clearly you're showing desire in this sense of self, which results in unhappiness. You've got to be like the screw, which is like this, which I don't know how to do. Even there, I was feeling some desire there. So clearly the screw is a better Buddhist than I am. But here then is my struggle. How can you actually strive to be more like that screw when you're supposed to strive to be nothing? I mean, how is that even a striving after anything? So Buddha says there is a 12-link chain of causation which continues to produce these mistaken perceptions and which continue to result in this karmic residue which causes rebirth and rebirth and rebirth. But I still have the basic problem of who and why. Why is it that this who I am is such a problem in the first place, and how do you even know that I am actually a problem? Is this not too easy a solution almost? And how is it actually different from just simple suicide and death? Isn't much of this in the first place based on a presupposition of Hindu beliefs? That there is such a thing as, well, maybe not Atman in Buddha's case, but something of a force that continues from one life to another. I mean, after all, he accepts rebirth. Why? Why not discard that completely? Why accept this Platonic conception? Who's to even say that Plato was correct? And if Buddha says, who is Plato? I would say, go check Hinduism. So you see, we have, I think, a bigger problem here. But assuming that you accept for now some of the premises, then Buddha taught four noble truths. The first states that all existence is characterized by dukkha. Now, Belvin, the first states that all existence is characterized by dukkha, which you are familiar with. I used to get confused between dukkha and dukku when I was a boy. But dukkha is obviously suffering. Dukku is a fruit. Second truth holds that the root cause of suffering is tana, which is literally thirst, but it's translated as desire. So why is it we suffer? The answer is desire. And here again, without meaning to make Buddhism equivalent to its followers, I've never understood how Buddhists can be serious about Buddhism. Because I find so many of my friends studying commerce, finance, economics, marketing with me, advertising in my university life, being Buddhists. But how can they possibly be fighting dukkha when they are obviously holding on to desires, including having a good job? I mean, that's like digging one hole and filling it in the next, spade on your left hand. I don't understand how you can be serious about Buddhism and about releasing yourself from rebirth if you are in this world. This morning I was suggesting to the people who are mostly workers, I said, if you have a Buddhist boss, maybe you should try this. When your Buddhist boss says to you, why didn't you fulfill your KPI? Why didn't you meet your sales target this week? I say, boss, you're Buddhist. Firstly, you yourself should not be desiring after this. It's bad for you. Oh, me, Taofoy. Okay? Secondly, you should not desire anything for me. The KPI, that thing you should just be more relaxed on, okay? Achieve, don't achieve. You want to get away from dukkha, right? In fact, thirdly, boss, why don't I be the boss? Because then you're not stressed, okay? then you can tell me the same thing I'm telling you now. So I tell you, hey, you know, this KPI how, just relax and say, firstly, I'm a Buddhist and that's all. Okay? But you see, I don't understand how Buddhists, the 95% of Chinese in Malaysia are actually Buddhists. If they really are on the IC, every time my boss or whoever yells at me and shows some dukkha because of their tana, I'm going to say, can I see your IC now, please? Why? I just want to see. See? She's Buddhist, right? Two noble truths. So I don't understand how there is a functional Buddhism in Malaysia, and I wish I could meet someone who was actually serious about this so that I can understand how they live in this world. I mean, their very lifestyle itself is a contradiction of Buddhism. And the next time someone says to you, this is kind of very petty, you Christians, you all don't behave like Christians. How can I believe in Jesus Christ? Look at our boss, Christian, right? Look at her. I would say, show me your IC. Okay, because I want to know, at least she is meant to be working in this world. God has placed her in this world to continue to work. And her yelling at us is probably because we haven't performed, right? As a Christian, that kind of is still, okay, maybe she shouldn't be so angry, but you're not meant to be even in this world. You're supposed to be in nirvana. Do you really want to be nothing? Because I can help you right now. I'm not going to just, okay. Anyway, it's not simply wrong desires. It's very important to see that it's not simply wrong desires that result in dukkha. Any desire. The screw is way ahead on being Buddhist compared to us. We're screwed. This screw is doing a lot better at being Buddhist than we are. 100%. Oh, screw, can you please teach me? I can't even get my face right. How do you do this thing where you're just so like nirvana-ish? Help me. So I find Buddhism particularly frustrating. If I had gone off to become a Buddhist, I probably would have frustrated my teachers, my senseis. Robin, you ask too much. Sensei, you are showing pain. Okay? I'm going to show you what pain is very soon. Sensei, I sense a disturbance. I'm sorry, but I really struggle with Buddhism. At least with Hinduism, there's a certain chaotic beauty to it. But with Buddhism, it tries so hard to be nothing. And I'm not sure it can succeed. So the third truth says that when the desire ceases, obviously dukkha will cease as well. I get that. And the fourth truth introduces the Noble Eightfold Path. Again, you see the method by which you may arrive at release from samsara, this version of moksha, is to meditate, be self-disciplined, but I'm sorry, sensei, this means desire. To desire to be morally self-disciplined is going to result in more dukkha. So your very system of solving the problem is generating more corruption. And I don't know how you're going to get out of that. Because I know another system, which is actually not just another system, but a reality where the problems and the corruption and desires and the pain you are describing is even worse than you can describe it in this one lifetime. It is so bad that God Himself had to offer Himself as a worthy sacrifice to take upon Himself that corruption. So whatever you are doing here is just a drop in the bucket of what is really needed. Anyway, this is the Eightfold Path. Through meditation and wisdom, etc., you will find eventually a way to eliminate desire and suffering. And again, here we see its Greek ultimate origins. There is, in fact, a Greek practice of meditation, which is almost similar to Buddhist meditation. You can read that on your own time. Hesychasm, okay, Hesychasm. So anyway, the basic idea is to eliminate desire and you eliminate suffering. And you, this inverted commas you, which is not to be you, gets to a state of bliss by not being an individual anymore because you've been released from an illusion of reality. Okay? The way it was described and explained to me by my Buddhist president friend from New South Wales University was, in nirvana, you are a drop of water returning to the ocean. And he said it with such a beatific smile, like he was telling me something really profoundly amazing. And I was inside recalling with horror Because all I could hear was suicide. I mean, you don't even have to talk about yourself. Just think about your own children. I don't know anyone here who carries his own child, this new creature that God has brought into this world, and thinks of this child as simply a pound of flesh that belongs to the carbon molecules of this world. You would never drop this child into an incinerator or a garbage truck. You would never treat this child as just a drop of water to be returned to the nitrogen or oxygen of the ocean. This child is unique. You are you. Whether you like it or not, you are you. In fact, it is not God-honoring and creation-honoring and you-honoring if you treat yourself as a nothing. That's precisely why there is a hell. Because God treats each of us as unique. He doesn't just say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to wipe out all your memories and turn you into carbon. It'll fertilize you. No, each and every one of you is responsible for how you have lived, and you need to be accounting for your life to God. He will ask you, what have you done in this life, and who are you, my child? And the way you answer, the way you have lived in relation to Jesus Christ, will determine your eternal future. There is an eternity for human beings because God, as Jesus said, is not the God of nobody and of the dead, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God of the living. We are not merely just screws and inanimate objects. So, to wrap up Hinduism and Buddhism, in a way, both Hinduism and Buddhism have a certain law aspect of morality, but as you can see, it's not a theistically based ethic. And this means that for them, sin is not a falling short of God's glory. And it's even more difficult in the case of Buddhism, because in Buddhism, the whole point is really to get away from this concept of self. In fact, because the Buddhist is on this very narrow quest within a pretty specifically defined problem inherited from Hinduism, which, in my view, actually takes a lot of belief, and that doesn't seem to worry Buddhists at all, but because they are on this narrow quest, so, in fact, the body is therefore relegated into a tool. And in a way, this again shows us how they owe much to their Greek DNA. Because you remember, for instance, in the 1 Corinthians text, in the Greek culture, what you do with your body, one particular form of Greek thinking, which Paul had to fight with in his church, one particular form of Greek thinking is that your body is a tool. So if you urinate, you're just urinating. You don't have to, like, oh, mother, please help. I'm about to urinate. Corruption is supposed to flow through my, going to flow through my body. Please cleanse me. It's just, ayo, go and pee, la. Peeing is peeing is peeing, okay? Digging your nose, peeing, doing the number two, whatever it is, it's just bodily fluids flowing through your body, and your body is just a tool. In the end, you'll be free from it. That is the Platonic ideal. In the same way, therefore, Buddhism, and of course, you know from 1 Corinthians, Paul had problems with this because the church people were sleeping with prostitutes, and their understanding was, I'm not corrupting anything, am I? Because after all, it's just a tool. But in Buddhism, we see this in terms of the body playing a part in the quest of nirvana, and so you should train yourself through the body by meditation, by fasting, by the giving of alms, by wisdom, etc. But it also means that if the goal is transcendence, to get away from it all, then in that way the body is something of a nothing, and it's relatively unimportant, because it's just something you use on the way to enlightenment. And therefore, in a way which I'm not sure is completely consistent, but Buddhists are open to many forms of sexual expression. The understanding is, or maybe the theory is, that for instance, if you prefer to release yourself with a man and you're a man, then, well, it's not really homosexuality as defined by the Judeo-Christian worldview with its ethical constructs designed around God's creation, but it's just you. I mean, if you want to stick it in there, that's up to you. Just stick it in, release it, and move on. But again, we have a problem with this, I think, false conception of the you. In fact, in this case, I think it's something very close to all of you, because nobody here, I think, ever really engages in these kinds of bodily exploits or desires without really being involved. How can you possibly, even as Buddhists, think that you can be involved sexually with someone without feeling or being ultimately involved? Many years ago, one of my friends was getting married, and he told me that his Buddhist friends were all sleeping together, and they had this particular conception of, shall we say, morality, which means it didn't matter at all. And their parents weren't that worried either. So before marriage, they're already having sex. And what did they do with prevention? Obviously, just use contraception. But it worries me, because what does it mean then to be married to a Buddhist, if you're a Buddhist? If this person is not really fully, personally, there in the I will, in the daily life of living together as a unit, if this person is simply using your body as you are using their body, and using your mind as you are using their mind, then in what way do we really have a relationship? In fact, as a Buddhist, why get married at all? In fact, if you have a child, and that child is inconvenient and wrongly placed, and we can end their life cycle early, and they can then move on to the next stage of attempting their next life, then why not just abort it if we have to? After all, maybe that child might even have less of a dukkha in this samsara. Maybe they might even achieve moksha earlier because they have, after all, less to suffer and desire. You see, Buddhism is ultimately suicidal and dangerous. Now, we may not see it this way. Buddhism, with its saffron monks, especially with the Dalai Lama being one of the most smiling men in the world, I don't know how he expresses non-desire in those smiles. Someone should say, Dalai Lama, you are showing desire. I don't understand how Buddhists can think about these things and not react to it. It puzzles me. But simply, I suppose we should note how it is one version of the Greek view, which has already been deconstructed and fought against by Christianity, which we Christians in Malaysia, I think, have not done our part in terms of also speaking against. And also, of course, you got to admit that many of your friends are not really seriously Buddhist in the first place. So every time they say to you, I'm not going to go to the church because I'm Buddhist, you should challenge that and ask them further. Okay, but everything we've said so far, I hope, is giving you more and more courage, hopefully not more and more confusion. But there is so much monism, monistic thinking, and also confused polytheism in Asian religion, that just doing these samples won't be enough. But as you can see, this already should give you some level of confidence to explore further and to keep thinking about this. Of course, the larger message is going to be this at the end, and I think we can confidently move there now. But again, what we are seeing here is the power and the clarity of the Christian gospel. I know that when I say it this way, some of you who are actually not Christian are just going to say, see, I knew it was going to be like this. That's why I didn't want to come. Because your pastor just like goes through my religion, mocks it, then you all laugh at me. I felt so alone. Then after that, you know, you make fun of me being Chinese, and because I'm from Chinese school in Johor. Then after you say Christianity is better. But I can't explain this to you this quickly, but from not only the bottom of my heart, but intellectually, with integrity, as a scholar, as someone who was an atheist for 3 months, who attempted to be Buddhist for a time, who was considering Islam for a few months, because especially I like this girl as well. Malay girls, Jun. In Malacca, we are not so yellow-oriented. But as someone who has thought through these things from hopefully an objective point of view, I think you must start to see that, in fact, all of religion is striving to find something which they cannot find, and they are all struggling with the same questions, which Christianity actually answers. So in fact, as we look at the variety of religions, not only have we found that these two major Asian religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, and Chinese religion as well, so we're essentially covering 60% of the population of the world here, really have an origin that's not different from the Greeks. And there has been an answer to that. And there has been an answer to that because Greek religion was itself flawed and faulty. Whereas Christianity really does show you that only the Son is the fulfillment of God's plans from creation to consummation. That we do not need to search for a self-salvation when in fact God explains what is actually the problem and what is actually the solution in both eschatological and ethical and anthropological terms. The solution to humanity is not found in human beings and their solutions, which often fall short and have fallen short. The solution is really in the Son who came from heaven to show us what the real problem, real solution was. So with that, we go to Islam, because these three done, they cover a major part of the way religions work. But the final one is the religion of law, of which the premier example is Islam. And religions of law, like Islam, ultimately are theistic, but where they, I know again you're going to think the same thing, but where they fall short is they don't have Christ. And so Islam is largely Christianity with Christ taken out, so that the Old Testament doesn't fully make sense anymore. You might ask, how is it that the Old Testament has anything to do with them? The answer is Muhammad was exposed to the Old Testament scriptures, and many of the basic aspects of Old Testament stories are actually transposed into the Quran, but with some fair bit of change and I would say corruption. So you should read the Quran for yourself so that you know what your Malay friends are actually reading and being brought up on. Otherwise, how are you going to reach out to them? So let's start with, just to be safe here, I'm just going to read out straight also from ESV, the study Bible. The Arabs of Mecca were largely animists and polytheists, although there were Jewish and Christian influences in the area. And I've always felt quite sad about the way in which I think maybe the Christians and the Jews of Muhammad's time who were in contact with Muhammad did not quite represent Christianity in the best way possible, which included correction of his views of himself being a prophet. So again, here is a helpful, I think, reminder for us to be valuing our opportunities to speak to our non-Christian friends of different religions and to actually get it right. This alone should be a reason for you to work hard at your theology. But living in Mecca, Muhammad himself was troubled by polytheism and superstition. You may often associate Arab religion with being monotheistic exclusively, but they were not like that to begin with. They were just like us, polytheistic. In fact, one unsubstantiated for me, maybe you have evidence for me, but one thing I've heard is that the Kaaba, which you know in Mecca they walk around, inside are all the religious artifacts from the polytheistic past. I'm not sure if this is true. Some of you have heard it as well. I don't know. But that is the background. I mean, and walking around it, by the way, is kind of strange, but that is the background to Islam. If you're in a different environment, I'd speak more openly, but it actually explains a lot of some of the characteristics or the more idiosyncratic aspects of Islam today. Whereas, again, I think Christianity is a lot more coherent and sensible theologically. But anyway, around the year 610, he began to have experiences that he took to be revelations from the one true God, Allah. Obviously, there we're using the word Allah, which is a controversial and problematic word in Malaysia. Maybe not in East Malaysia, but in West Malaysia. Anyway, convinced that he had been called to be a messenger of God, Muhammad continued to receive revelations supposedly dictated by the angel Gabriel over a 20-year period. It must be said at this point that Muhammad is in fact illiterate, so these were then dictated to others. Take it as you will for now, but it does say something about Muhammad and his intelligence and his character and his abilities, especially since he was actually a successful businessman with his wife Khadija. So it tells us something about the qualities of this man, that he wasn't actually able to, he wasn't actually literate, and yet at the same time he could lead in this way. But it also does possibly raise some questions of how cogent these revelations were then were in their recordings. So the revelations were then memorized and then written and codified in the Quran, which is understood to be the word of God. Muhammad regarded himself as being in continuity with the prophets of the Old Testament and Jesus. He claimed to be restoring the original revelation of God that Jews and Christians had corrupted. So I want to raise again to you the question of Muhammad. We don't have all the information we need, but this therefore creates a very tenuous position for Islam, in my view. If you ask me what Isaiah knew, such that he could write what he wrote, whilst at the same time being inspired and having visions from God, it's very easy for us to point to everything from Genesis all the way to what Isaiah had as a canon of Old Testament scripture. The same goes for Jeremiah, same goes for Ezekiel, same goes for Zechariah, Micah, Hosea, Jonah, the whole lot. These are literate people who know God through the oracles of God. That's what Paul claims in Romans 9. So they know what they're saying because God not only has revealed himself to them, but because they also have a canon of scripture from which they can develop a clear theology. But if you have the founder of a new corrective movement, which claims to be the important final chapter of what God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has been doing, and he cannot really understand the theology of the Old Testament prophets, then we have a major problem. Now, what I've tried to say to you is this. Hinduism is your problem. Because your ancestors, your apostolic ancestors, fought it and they won. Chinese religion is your problem. Because, just look lah. Hinduism is your problem if you're Indian. Okay, let's just get that over with. Buddhism is your problem. Because again, it's Neoplatonic. But Islam is most definitely your problem, because Islam is telling the whole world and has been telling the whole world for hundreds of years, since the 600s, that Christianity is false because it is not the real thing. That Christians have got it corrupted, that a conference like CTC is wrong because it doesn't preach ultimately what Muhammad taught. Do you understand? You go into CTC, creation and consummation of Christ in the center, that is a problem, because you are basing that whole understanding, that whole invitation of this white guy from Union or whatever it is based on understanding that Christ is the center of scriptures. But you know, you don't even have the right scriptures, the Muslims would say. You know, you don't even hear Muhammad, who is the final explanation for what really took place, and he is therefore the point, ultimately, which corrects the point of scripture. Muhammad was sent to fix things and you're missing him. Now, you can't say, therefore, that these two religions can simply coexist without continuous debate, without engagement. You definitely cannot allow what's happening in East Malaysia, where so-called Christian, Sarawakan, Sabahan young men and women are marrying into Islam without any thought. That alone speaks volumes about the state of the church in East Malaysia. But don't think that that is too far from us here in West Malaysia. The only reason why you're not doing it is because you are somewhat prejudiced against the Malay culture, I think. I thank God I grew up in Malacca, where we grew up singing songs you would consider to be rock, mud rock songs. Today I sing Search to my apprentices and they don't know who I'm talking about. I talk about Amy and they're like, is that a girl? I said, no, that's a rock singer. Okay, never mind. You're Malaysians and you don't seem to understand that right at your doorstep is this issue from 6:10, involving people whom you call your friends, bosses, colleagues, etc. So let me encourage you, as much as there is officially and to some extent legally and properly a ban on your evangelization of Muslims, if a Muslim person asks you what you believe, be very prepared to speak of the same God of Isaac and Abraham and Jacob, whom they claim we have now misrepresented. Muhammad claimed, therefore, to be restoring the original revelation of God that Jews and Christians have corrupted. Okay, I don't care what version of Muhibba you have in your mind, but if you really believed in Muhibba, it would involve conversation that dealt with this. Okay, moving on. Both branches of Islam, of Sunni and Sufi, embrace a strict monotheism. Sunni and Shia, strict monotheism. These two branches have different views on who actually inherits the leadership of the Ummah, the Muslim Brotherhood, and I won't go into that. As I told you, this is just brief. But Islam calls for essentially acknowledgement of the incomparable greatness of Allah and submission to His sovereign will in all of life. So in that, we have complete agreement. And if someone asks me, am I Muslim in this sense, in the sense that Islam is expressed in being a Muslim and a Muslim is one who submits, with this sentence you've just read, I would claim to be a Muslim, 100%. It's essentially what Romans 1 says is the faith of obedience. When we trust Jesus Christ, we are submitting to His Lordship. In fact, I'll remind you that my lecturer, my prof Robert Doyle in theology, would always tell us the only true Muslim in the world is the Lord Jesus Christ. Because only He has truly and fully submitted to God's will. So our own founder of our religion, the Lord Jesus Christ, is Himself a true Muslim. And I would challenge any Muslim to prove to me that Jesus is not the one true Muslim. So in fact, we share more than you even might care to acknowledge. Allah is this deserving one who deserves our submission precisely because He is the sovereign creator. So when you do two ways to live with your friends who are Muslim, you should have zero trouble with pictures 1 to 3. I usually enjoy 1 to 3 because it's like, it's a smooth run, and maybe if I'm procrastinating, I hang out on 1 to 3 a bit more. But you see, the way you draw 1 to 3 is exactly the way the fight will end up. Pictures 2 and 3 perfectly mirror pictures 4 and 5. Precisely because God is sovereign over His people and judges them, Jesus Christ dies and resurrects for those people. So Islam, when you draw two ways to live out, is very clearly deficient because it doesn't actually have the two boxes that match the first, the second and third. You understand? Picture 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's why it cannot have 6. So Islam in that way is heartbreaking. Unlike our Buddhist third cousins and our Hindu third cousins, Islam is a very close second cousin. Roman Catholic is first cousin. But Islam is a very close second cousin because they are very near. They too agree with submission to God. And if God was to send the Messiah in a way that maybe Muhammad had explained differently, they might even submit to Him. I'm not saying they will. I'm saying theoretically, the framing is there. But in the end, they do not have forgiveness. In the end, Islam is a salvation by works. And that is why the religious, intellectual, and social life of devout Muslims is structured around the 5 pillars, the Shahada, which is the creed. You just have to say it to start being a Muslim. Second is prayer. It always worries me when Christians start looking like they have the 5 pillars as well. Theirs would be more, 1, saying, I believe in Jesus, 2, praying, 3, fasting, 4, giving charity, 5, going to Jerusalem. Never mind if you don't get the joke. 5 pillars of Islam: Shahada, prayer, fasting, almsgiving, and a pilgrimage to Mecca. Islam, in fact, teaches that the present world will one day be destroyed by Allah, and that all humankind, past and present, will then be raised to face divine judgment. Human beings have a weakness of will and a tendency towards sin. Okay, they would acknowledge that. But see how they're not quite defining sin in its fullest extent of the problem. And although humans are tempted by the devil, I sadly always read Iblis as Bilis, Ikan Bilis. This is kind of dumb, but I do these things. That's my problem, really. Although human beings are tempted by the devil, it is within their power. See how they have a devil? It is within their power to resist and remain faithful to the will of Allah. So let's test you. What is this? So strip away the Arabic side of things. Strip away the color and the desert nomad images and people shouting, Allahu Akbar on camels. Just look at it theologically, and what do you see? Oh, very good. But that was one staff saying it, so I don't know about the rest of you. So in case you didn't hear it, this is essentially Pelagianism, yes? So you just need to be, it's a religion of works. You just need to be educated. So once you see that, then if you care for Pelagians and you work at talking to them in your universities, etc., then you should also talk to Muslims. Just because they have a different color and they listen to Hujan, it doesn't mean that they don't need... I mean, what's the difference between a Pelagian who listens to Hujan and a Pelagian who doesn't listen to Hujan? One's cooler, that's all. Okay? But both are still going to suffer in the ultimate life, right? Because it teaches that one day the world will be destroyed and they will be raised. We will be raised to fight, face divine judgment. So they are Pelagian. That's the issue. Not that they are Muslim or Malay or they pray in a mosque that shouts a lot through your suburb that it's time to pray. All these things are, in a way, just artifacts. Just think about the theological reality. Think about the human beings who are going to burn in hell. So if they are Pelagian, they're in trouble. And if they are Pelagian, they are gospel targets, obviously. They are people who should be listening to the gospel so that God may show his love to them and save them. Because they wrongly believe, obviously, that there is a power to resist and remain faithful to the will of Allah. And in fact, our experience and from those who are working at this, they tell us that there is a serious degraded side to this community. They really struggle in this internal consistency that their religion teaches them to have. And we know that, obviously. Islam is not the newest kid on the block with the latest news and the latest solutions. Jeremiah 31 has already been telling us this. Genesis 3, chapter 2, already knows this problem. So for them to suddenly appear 600 years after the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the payment of our sins and to say, we've found a new solution, and it is this. And the answer is, work harder. All 1 billion of us should just have stood up and said, what? Listen, sit down, Pelagian. Let's talk. And that's why I hope it's apocryphal, but that story of the Christian merchants who were reluctant to tell Muhammad that he was not the solution is to this day a burning embarrassment and worry for me. They were trading in his region. They needed his protection. He claimed he was a prophet and this final one, and they avoided saying too much. Well, now we have a billion-man religion of works. 600, 2,000 years after Jesus Christ already died so that we might have grace. And then after that, the Twin Towers. Because salvation is strictly based on the submission to Allah and faithful adherence to the teachings of Islam. In fact, if you've sinned a lot in life, if you want to have a fail-sure, or when you want to have a fail-safe solution, just like in a way that the Crusades were wrongly based on a false theology, because knights were promised eternal paradise if they died for the Pope's cause. Well, if you really want to fail safe, then die in jihad and automatically you'll be sure. That should not happen in this world when Jesus has already made clear nothing can save you except faith. The Quran makes all this very clear in Surah 53, no soul shall bear another's burden, and that each man shall be judged by his own labors. Hear this very carefully and feel the pinch. Feel the way in which your non-Christian friends listening to your debate will actually agree with Surah 53, with the sentiments. Because as your Muslim friend is explaining this and say, you explain Christianity to me since John is here from England. The Surah 53 says, I'm responsible, correct? This is not an abort meeting. Whoever screws up, he's responsible. I don't blame it on you, right? But then in Christianity, you guys say, God just like absorbs it all. I mean, that's so wrong, right? And then your evangelical friend or you yourself, you're like stuck and you're like, but you know, it's all about love, you know. Love just washes it all. So basically, even my son is a drug addict. He burns down a couple of houses, kills people, rapes people. Then I just tell the judge, just be more loving, lah. Is that a good judge? Is that a good country? One MDB just happened. You Chinese people fought for it, right? I actually voted UMNO, lah, but you also don't like it, right? Then you want me to believe that a religion that where everything's just like, you know, beres because of this heart-shaped thing. Then you and your evangelical friend go, yeah, it's just about love. Religion, Christianity is all about love, man. But that's not what we see in Hebrews, right? In fact, this surah, Surah 53, 38, we can agree with it. That's precisely why you need mediation. That's precisely why you need a high priest. The answer is not in saying, hey, you know, Islam has got some good things. Christianity is just better because there's more love in it. No. When you get into the issues which each religion presents, they all come back to the same issue of how can we be acceptable before God? How can any other person bear our burdens? That's exactly the question. That is the miracle of Jesus Christ, of the gospel. What is John from England going to learn if we don't answer this in the right way? What are we going to do with Surah 36, 54, which says, you shall be rewarded according only to your deeds. You were at CTC for a week, and you found out that that's exactly right. In Christianity, God does reward you. But again, having Christ changes our understanding about works done after salvation as well. So you have to work hard at these things to make sure not only the non-Christian, the Muslim, is helped, but you yourself don't misrepresent Christianity, because Islam is an alternative Christianity. It is a false Christianity, but it is an alternative form of the Judeo or the Jesus, the Judeo-Christian religion. In fact, Islam talks about Jesus a lot. He's the son of Mary. He's born by a miracle. He will come back to judge. He is, in fact, called the Messiah. But it's complicated and it's confused. But still, it's undeniable that one of the key prophets in Islam is Jesus Christ. Well, maybe not the Christ, but Nabi Isa. Do you understand? And you are respectfully called the people of the book. There is kafir, people who have rejected the truth. There's people who are ignorant, but you're in a special category. You are the people of the book. That's one reason why people, Muslims, were outraged when people firebomb churches. Because those are ignorant boys on motorcycles who don't understand. So you have, in a way, a duty or a relationship, a prior relationship with Muslims, because they are second cousins. Not first, but they're still cousin-like. Think about it. Now, we may consider then with this as our landscape. I'm thankful that you managed to pull it, hold on this far. That's more religion than you've ever received. I bet some of you are like, can we go back to the Bible soon? I'll never complain about the Bible again, man. I love the Bible now. It's so fantastic. Okay, we'll do it now. We may consider then the uniqueness and grace of the Christian gospel in the following categories. the larger header here is God has spoken. That's my way ultimately of answering in one short clause all the claims of the different religions. Heaven has not spoken in the Chinese Empress, in the Tang Dynasty. He has not ultimately spoken in the Empress Edicts. In Hinduism, we don't even know who speaks. In Buddhism, no one speaks. But in Islam, the claim is that God has spoken, but we screwed it up, and Muhammad now speaks finally and fully. But the claim from the book of Hebrews is this: God has spoken in His Son. And unless Islam can prove beyond doubt that Christians have corrupted the scriptures, which, by the way, the best scholars in the world can't find proof of, the Bible is one of the most well-preserved documents in the history of humankind. But if they claim this, they will have to prove it, and they cannot prove it. So God, in fact, has spoken, and He has spoken clearly in His Son about His holiness and the problem of our sin. In the last few weeks of preaching, we got to a point in Hebrews where the reality of sin was seen very clearly in the temple. I thought of putting a diagram up, but I think no need lah. But the arrangements of worship made it clear of this problem of God's holiness versus our sin. And as we said, when we look at these things before, as we said, whilst presenting on one hand the hope of a future where man could in fact meet God and be with Him, as the prophets hope for in that refrain that He will be our God and we will be His people in His place, then the temple was a hopeful place, but then at the same time, the temple was largely negative. I suppose you have to say that in the first covenant, because it remained a massive statement of our rebellion, and that's why death had to always be compensated for. Sin had always been compensated for in terms of death and sacrifice. Our sin against God is what the temple shouted out at us about. So in chapter 9, verse 7 to 9, we'll now turn to the scriptures very quickly. As I move through the scriptures, please keep up. 9, 7 to 9, into the second section, the most holy of holies. Only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers him for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. I'm just jogging your memory here. I can't afford to go through all of it. Just remember, second section, only high priest, no others, only once a year, and then there must be sacrifice. All that should say, people are sinful, God is holy. All this, verse 8, by this the Holy Spirit, all this is indicating by the Holy Spirit that the way into the holy places is not yet open as long as the first section is still standing. It's not just speaking here about our route inside the temple, but it's speaking here about a real access to God in His holy presence. All this is symbolic for the present age. And so the landscape of salvation, starting from Genesis all the way, involving the Confucian landscape, involving the Hindu or the Buddhist mindset or the Greek, this whole landscape is affected by this massive river like the one in China, occupying 5 or 6 miles wide, cutting across the whole land, flooding the whole land at any time. The landscape of salvation is affected by this massive river of sin. It's affected by sin, it's shaped by sin, it's determined by sin, like a large, monstrous, snaking river running through the land. This is something we cannot avoid, and we must begin with in our understanding and appreciation and evaluation of all religion. Any religion that cannot answer the question of sin is not truly able to deliver. The description of the necessity of the incarnation makes this point clear. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 to 15. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, He Himself likewise partook of the same things. He was incarnate. Why? That through death He might destroy the one who has power of death. See the problem? Like a large snaking river of sin through the land, we are all affected by this flooding of sin into our lives, which results ultimately in death, because the master behind this is the devil. And we need to be delivered, verse 15, from the fear of death as we are subject to lifelong slavery. Sin is clearly not merely a problem which laughably Confucianism thought it could solve through moral discipline. And then in the highest form, in self-realization in Buddhism, through the discipline of bodily works and meditation. Sin is clearly not a problem that any moral disciplines can solve. It's disheartening when we see Christians adopting the same mindset as past religion. And even the structured arrangement of bhakti or puja cannot actually solve this problem of sin. How many temples are you going to roll on the floor of? How much alms are you going to give across India? How many times are you going to bathe in the Ganges River? Whatever puja you give to Shiva and Vishnu, in the end, Islam is the greatest expression of this total dedication. And then you are stuck with, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's one side of the coin, you are stuck with the need to be perfect. As Jesus said, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Submit to Him fully. Hinduism stops short. Islam expresses it fully. If you really want a puja and bhakti, give it to the one true God and give your whole life. Don't roll around in temples. Give your whole life. But will it be enough? Both Islam and Christianity hang at the precipice and look down in the chasm and wonder at one point what the answer will be. But even then, the Old Testament prophets knew better than Islam. Well, the answer was 2,000 years before Muhammad even struggled with this. Because the answer was always going to be the Christ. But this sin is where you begin to understand the size of the chasm, the size of the problem, the size of the river sneaking through the landscape of salvation. Christians, in fact, in the Sermon of Hebrews, in chapter 3, verse 13, are warned against the deceitfulness of sin. Deceitfulness of sin produces religion. If you are fortunate, you will be closer to the precipice, to the questions that will lead you to the solution, or at least make you ready for the Messiah. But if you are less, I suppose, fortunate, I don't mean here in terms of luck, I just mean it as an expression, and you will be born in a great wandering desert of samsara, where you will wander literally looking for the solutions and creating answers which in the end are part of the suppression of truth and deceitfulness of sin. Buddha rightly felt the fallen nature of this world in the first beggars he saw as he was outside the compound of his palace lifestyle. But Buddha himself had a problem which he could not resolve, which is that he himself was already deceived by sin into finding a solution which would come up short in any case. But through that, he would deceive even more. So 3 verse 13 is a reminder for us, in light of the religions we have just looked at, of how sin really leaves us helpless. That only God can cut through religious rubbish, religious confusion, and save us. This inability, this enslavement, is in fact captured for us in all these arrangements that other religions have in looking for God, but also perfectly in Judaism, which had in fact arrangements of worship from God Himself. And that itself, in its actual ordained system and structure, was to express this enslavement and handicap. But not only that, not only do we have the temple explaining this to us, shouting at us of our condition and problem, but also the real experience, almost in an empirical, laboratory-tested way, the real experience of the history of Israel in covenant failure. The problem is not merely liturgical and ecclesiastical. The problem is actually human beings and a real inability to be faithful to God according to the ideals of Islam. So Israel failed, and thus there was always a need for a new covenant. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 7 to 9, "For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second." The moment you have a first covenant with a second pre-anticipated and built in. I repeat, the moment you have a first covenant with a second pre-anticipated and built in, it already speaks volumes of the uselessness of every other religion. Because that covenant and that temple with its centerpiece being the whole liturgical worship Unlike the Hindu with no ecclesiastical structure and his search for the gods, God or no God or the unknown God, that temple was kosher. That temple was given by God himself. And that itself was designed not to be the final one. If the first temple was itself designed to only be provisional, what more Hinduism? All 4,000 years of it. It doesn't matter whether the temple existed only 1 year compared to Hinduism's 4,000 years of temples. If God gives you 1 year of an Exodus 24 design temple as a pattern of God's own glorious temple in heaven, and tells you that this temple, in fact, is designed to show you your failure, it speaks volumes of how all religion cannot save. What more Chinese religion, which tries to listen to the sky? What more Buddhism, which tries to find itself in not finding itself? So he finds fault with them and he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt." For, see the failure, the handicap, the enslavement, and the deceit, they did not continue in my covenant. They did not continue in something that was good for them. And so I showed no concern for them. So again, this last bit I don't have a lot of time for, but this last bit is a reminder that the problem of religion is it fails, in fact, to be measured by God's own perfect standards. Whilst it assumes that it is reaching for the nirvana or the theistic endpoint or high point of being divine like God, it in fact fails to even measure up to God's own true standards. If God really was to be the measure, then evil would have to be dealt with as evil. And when God deals with evil, he is serious about being good at it. He does not tolerate evil, close his eyes, and allow his murderous and selfish Israelites to continue to destroy this world. He actually treats them as they deserve. Yes, you suppress the truth, I will give you over. Chapter 1. You refuse to listen to me, I will exile you. God is actually good in the way that he shows how he treats evil as evil. But in Buddhism, it is a confusing mixed bag of ethics. And Confucianism is a moral order designed by ourselves, for ourselves, according to ourselves. In Hinduism, well, it all depends on what your bhakti and your caste and your samsara is. So this is the point we must keep remembering. Each category of religion that we briefly surveyed already has large unanswerable questions of importance. So even, for instance, like the larger assumption in Buddhism is monistic framing. I mean, how do you even get that in terms of the evidence for that? But even more damning and desperate is this. Judaism was the direct knowledge of God, and it was not the solution. Once Judaism fails, as it was designed to, you know religion cannot save. It was, in fact, founded on God's self-revelation. Romans 9, verse 4, they are the Israelites. To them belong the adoption. They are God's specially elect people. To them belong the glory of God in his own heavenly glory. To them belong the covenants, a specially framed relationship with God directly. Do the Hindus actually have that with Brahman? The giving of the law, the worship, the promises, the actual knowledge of God and his will, the possibility, at least technically, to be righteous like God. The worship itself, the whole system of approaching God in his holy, physical, majestic presence. And the promises, the hope for the future, where there would be a final resolution for us being with God. The Israelites had all this, and God still was going to replace the whole thing with a final new covenant. Because the promises are just that. They're just promises when they are without the Christ of the promises. So Judaism with all its direct knowledge of God, points irrevocably to the failure of man. And religion, therefore, points even more to the deceitfulness of man in suppressing the truth against God in their own religion. So ultimately, all religions are demonic. As Paul, the perfect Jew, explains, when he himself considers his life as a Jew, he had more reason than anybody to be confident of salvation, and yet he could not be so. Verse 4, Philippians 3, if anyone else thinks he has reason for confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day. If my body is a tool, it is a perfected tool. Because also I am of the people of Israel, see Romans 9:4 for the benefits. I am of the tribe of Benjamin, it's a good tribe. I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, as the law of Pharisee. I've disciplined myself. I've conformed to God's expectations. I have met his requirements. In fact, I've gone further than that. In terms of zeal, when it came to protecting God's people, I persecuted this sect of Christians, the church. In fact, in terms of the law, I was blameless. And yet, he says in Philippians, I am a failure. Again, if Paul fails, then most certainly Muhammad is also a failure. Buddha is also a failure. Mother Teresa is also a failure. Lao Tzu, Confucius, is also a failure. Most certainly, if Paul has failed, everyone else has to have failed. You can't get better than a Paul body and mind and soul. And yet, he is not good enough. Judaism, in fact, shows that it is the ultimate religion ordained by God. You can't show me any proof that Yahweh directed the building of the Temple of Heaven in Beijing. You can't show me any proof that the religions we've covered and others have direct mandate from God and instructions in the way that we have of Exodus 24 and others. Judaism is the ultimate religion ordained by God with direct mediated access that shows failure. The very fact that religions exist shows a failure to appreciate what happened in the Jewish people's lives. The reality is, therefore, left alone, man cannot enter God's presence, not in the temple made of hands, not in the true temple, of course, of God's permanent presence, the ultimate place where God is. Hebrews 3:19 captures it rightly. They were unable to enter because of their unbelief. So Judaism proves, demonstrates, is the experience of both the real and the past and the future and the potential failure of all religion. Tomorrow, you can start a new religion with better specs, better specifications. You can do a new rig and try to make it better, but you will still fail because Judaism failed. I honestly don't even know why Tom Cruise is a Scientologist. I just don't understand why he's a Scientologist. Do they not even know? I'm sure he knows this, that Ron Hubbard started it on a bet. Everybody knows that. It was in a bar. They decided to... Why is he a... I don't even know why I watch Mission Impossible sometimes. When I watch it, I feel stupid. When I watch it, I feel like, why am I watching this guy and contributing his immense wealth when he's just... He's part of a scam. I feel stupid watching this, but then the children want to watch it, so... I mean, the other day I made a mistake. My daughter was like, Daddy, he's not married to Kate anymore. I said, he's not? He's divorced 3 times already. I thought it was just once. No, Dad, 3 times. Tom is divorced 3 times. He's failed marriage 3 times. Why? We have to learn from Judaism. The solution is in Christ. In fact, Christ is this wonderful, unique king. His uniqueness is captured for us right in chapter 1, before the Hebrews writer even goes to his sermon on the uniqueness of his priesthood. The first thing to establish, over and above all religion, is the uniqueness of the Son in and of himself. So, for instance, Hebrews 1:5-6, we captured this in the structure. of the text. Well, I did this for you as a table. If you remember the first sermon, this is bringing back memories, I hope, in January. The son's ontological difference is seen in, you are my son, meaning in Psalm, in Hebrews 1 verse 5, he is God the Son, because he's pre-incarnate. In fact, it's spotted by Hebrews 1 verse 6, where it says, all God's angels worship you, which would be blasphemous if he wasn't actually God the Son, or God the Son. And then Hebrews 1, 7 to 8, there's a functional difference, because you can see there, it speaks in verse 8 of his throne, so he is to be king, to be occupying David's throne, so he's to be the Messiah. So God the Son is going to occupy the throne to be king, functionally, over God's people. So here is a unique pre-incarnate being who is God, who is going to be king of God's people. And then in verse 9, the son's moral character is impeccable. Now, I can't say the same for certain religious leaders. I don't know about Buddha very much, but I do know about a major world religion where the founder was incredibly desirous of women, for instance. I won't say more. But the son instead has impeccable moral character. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. In fact, he's like God. If you know a religion will not work, it is because its founder is not, in the end, a good mediator of God's own character, whereas the son actually is. And Hebrews 1, 10 to 12, the son has eternality, whereas all, there's a Shailene song which you probably could memorize the rap for. He just sings again and again, right? Muhammad is dead. Buddha is dead. Baha'u'llah is dead. Jesus is alive. Saddam is dead. Onassis is dead. is dead. Jesus is alive. It goes on for like 5 minutes like that. It's just a simple rap for the resurrection saying, you know what? All the founders of different religions, etc., they're dead. They're dead. The only one who is eternal is the Son. Again, I want to say to you, as you listen to these things, aren't you feeling a little bit ashamed? My Buddhist friends don't know this, and they're stuck in Buddhism. Well, they should know this before they get stuck in Buddhism. Don't you think? It's in a way, it's their right to know what they are rejecting. And therefore, you will heap burning coals on their heads. But they should know this. For God's glory, they should know this. For God's Son's glory, the Eternal One, they should know this. And so, Hebrews 1, verse 13 to 14, the Son will ultimately be the conqueror of all of God's enemies. Verse 13, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. As I've said, none of these has ever been claimed by the founders of different religions. In fact, Muhammad was very clear that you're not to worship him. He's simply a messenger. You would insult a Muslim if you said that Islam is about Muhammad. That would not go down well. Islam is about God. There is a rightness to it. But you know what? You can rightly make them unhappy by saying Christianity is about Jesus. And if they put you in jail, so be it. Because you know what? Christianity is about Jesus because God is for Jesus. God made this pre-incarnate divine Son, the King of His people, through His death, so that He would rise up and bring His people finally in the end as their priest to this eternal future. And together with Him, would therefore conquer all the enemies of God. This is the message of Christ, because we are not speaking simply of another way, another moksha, another noble truth. This is the truth, the way and the life. If you sell Christianity any shorter than you already are selling it, according to what I've seen in Klang Valley, then you are seriously a traitor to the truth and God Himself. This is where religion is. This is where Judaism is. And Christianity is somewhere in the ozone. And some of you are selling Christianity around about lower than Islam sometimes. Because you want to be all politically correct and saying, I don't know, all religions are about the same. Says who? Are you even a Christian for saying that? We have to stop. We have to stop not only misunderstanding, but misrepresenting the glory of Christ. Jesus is either truly unique or a full-blown liar. we should really persecute Christians as ex-Christians if this is a lie. So you better make up your mind, CRC, and you better be willing consistently to die for this reality. Not because you are radicals and fundamentalists, in a way we are fundamentalists, but because you actually understand the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. And in any case, guys, such a claim could never have lasted. You know, if you say nothing in a room, no one's going to pay attention to you and no one's going to shoot you out. But if you stand in a room and you make such big claims, you better be ready to back up those claims. If you're saying, I am the Son of God and I have come to die for everyone and I'll rise up in 3 days, well, you better rise up in 3 days or we'll kill you. In fact, let's kill you now. And then you rise up in 3 days. Well, good. Now that you've actually made that claim, it can be verified. The resurrection has happened. And therefore, we do, in fact, have a salvation that we can inherit. This is a large claim that must be made largely by Christians in this generation and forevermore. Don't keep selling short this Christianity. Don't sit here in church for 4 hours and then go back on Monday simply to say nothing or to say something roughly the same as what everybody else is saying. Say it loud. I don't mean literally. We are those who are to inherit salvation, 1 verse 14 says, because in fact, our Christ, this Christ, is unique. As 5 verse 9 to 10, and we've got to speed up here because I've got a lot of verses to just run through. 5 verse 9 to 10, it says, He became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey Him, being designated by God as the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And the Hebrews preacher knows this, and in 5 to 6, he uses not an unknown combination of Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, but here he does it with a particular emphasis, emphasizing the Melchizedekan reality of Psalm 110, which is a little bit unique to the Hebrews writer, actually. So the unique high priesthood here we see through 5:5-6, expressing his Melchizedekan membership of the order of Melchizedek. So you are my son, we are more familiar with that, Psalm 2, but also you are a priest forever. And this unique high priesthood is key to our salvation. And it demonstrates the manner in which God was, in fact, always being provisional. There's no insult in the temple being provisional, no sense of a plan A that didn't work when it is compared to Christ. That would be like thinking opening for Taylor Swift is a bad thing. That would be like thinking opening for Metallica is a bad thing. The temple should not be thought of as a bad thing when, in fact, what you have coming after you, you are not even worthy to untie his sandals for off. When it is Christ, nothing should be seen as bad when it comes before, because it all is leading to the wonderful uniqueness of this very special priesthood. There's nothing wrong with being a Levitical priest, serving in a provisional way, time after time, in a finally ineffective sacrificial system. Because it is provisional. In a way, it is a privilege. It's as privileged as my daughter being a tree in a play. And she tells me, I don't want this role because all I am is a tree. Honey, if there wasn't a tree there, how would the hero knock his head, fall in love with the girl or something like that? Your arm is important. So now that you put it like that, Daddy, thank you. Exactly. You see, all of this is well understood when we appreciate the glories of Christ, the uniqueness of this high priesthood, which is key to our salvation, demonstrated in the order of the Levitical priesthood leading to the order of Melchizedek. Thus, we see Hebrews 7 verse 11 saying, Now if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to rise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one name after the order of Aaron? And verse 18, a formal commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. It's not going to be as good as Jesus, obviously. So it's a good thing it came because it's provisional, but the law made nothing perfect, verse 19. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. For us to stay with Judaism would be terrible, because that is only the so-called window dressing or what leads up to the final thing. But on the other hand, now a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. 7 verse 21, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. This is the key. Psalm 110, anticipation and promise and oath of a Jesus who will be a unique priest This is the key. This makes Jesus, verse 22, the guarantor of a better covenant. What covenant can the Buddhists hope for? Nothing. But here in Jesus, we have the covenant that's better than the covenant which anticipated it. Islam is stuck in the first covenant in a way. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he's able to save. He is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him. Religion can only try to give you a way, possibly, to self-salvation, to moksha. But Christianity is not a religion. Christianity is God working in history. It is as real as gravity. It is as real as seatbelts that save. God has worked at a real problem with a real solution. And Jesus Christ, therefore, in these verses we can see, is actually able to save to the uttermost. Maybe before tonight you didn't understand the problem. Well, now you do. And now you also have the solution. It comes in one package. If you understand the solution, you understand what kind of problems you have, and therefore you should become a Christian tonight. And maybe tonight with the solution, you are now thinking, do I really have to accept this? But do you understand what kind of danger you are in if you are continuing in these religions, which themselves should have taught you to search for a salvation solution, but have failed? In fact, the clock is ticking. These things we have talked about, they proceed in a linear fashion. Buddhism and Hinduism may argue that there's a constant cycle of rebirth and they'll repeat and repeat and repeat. Maybe that is why my New South Wales University Buddhist friends are in such a relaxed attitude about a struggle with dukkha and desire. Because in the end, they're going to reboot. But as far as I understand Buddhism, you can get rebooted as a cockroach, you know. I step on them every day. How is that a good thing? Maybe like, then just reboot, lor. I don't think that's the way Buddha wanted you to think. But in any case, what puts a stop to that whole idea of rebooting and always having eternal chances? Maybe this is a Dota gaming mindset, just respawn, or whatever it is. But the reality is that in the reality of the world that God has created, as sure as the terra firma under you, the earth is real, as sure as gravity is real, and there's an ozone above our heads, the reality is Jesus Christ appeared because God the Son, according to Hebrews chapter 1, became a man incarnate in round about the year 30 plus or before AD in Nazareth of Palestine. And we thought he was just a joker walking around telling us all sorts of fancy tales. But then he started doing stuff which demonstrated to us that in fact something big was going down. And then as he taught, he promised that he would die for our sins and he was the true high priest of the people. And all sorts of people started understanding Old Testament prophecies. And then he actually died and we thought it was all over. And then he resurrected. And next thing you know, the apostles start explaining to us the meaning of the whole scriptures. Then we suddenly realize Islam cannot be true. Neither can Buddhism or any one of the other isms, because now the Messiah has actually turned up. And that means the clock is ticking. Because Hebrews 9:28 says he will return, he will appear a second time, not to deal with sin. That was the first time. That means there's a first time, and there's a second time, and the second time is the end time. And we live in the end times already, where the first time means the clock has started ticking. There is a bomb that's going to drop on you. It's called the apocalypse. And if you understand the point of Jesus' coming, you have nothing to fear about Judgment Day itself. Because all that fear was the point of his death for us. Hebrews chapter 3. So therefore, Jesus has dealt with that fear of death which we deserve because of our sin. He's died for those sins. But he will appear again, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly awaiting for him. Hebrews 9:28, unless you are, 9:27, going to face judgment because you refuse to acknowledge the problem which your own religions put forward to you again and again. Have you arrived at moksha? Are you in nirvana? Clearly not. You're with me. You're clearly not in nirvana, okay? What's your next life going to be like? You living well enough? I've already created so many desires in you, you're back 5 steps already. As a Buddhist, you're failing right now. As a Hindu, you're really going to be struggling. As a Muslim, you're even worse if you're honest with yourself. All these views of multiple reboots and multiple chances clash directly with Jesus' one birth, one life, one death, one resurrection, one ascension. If Jesus is sent by God to be his high priest, to live and die according to God's plan and save his people, then you cannot expect any more chances other than the ones you have in this life to receive this gospel, to draw near to God through him, because Christ has already been sent. The clock is ticking, and it's ticking only one way. Because this self-revelation of God is seen in his Son. And he can save us. Please embrace him tonight. But the consequence, I hope you hear this clearly, is no religion can save. Christianity, in fact, my dear brothers and sisters, those of you who are Christian, is a full and final proclamation of salvation, so naturally it will sound arrogant. I acknowledge that. I'm not one of those pastors, unfortunately, and this is partly my fault, who make clear proclamations in a soft, gentle voice. Christianity is very true. I don't know how that works. I think if it's serious, you got to do it. My own children don't respond to, like, you know, doing homework is important, yeah. That doesn't sound like it's important. Maybe not overshouting either. But Christianity, taking away from even the volume or the issues of manner, which often this church gets accused of, it still will sound arrogant if you understand its claims. The claims itself are arrogant. But it naturally should sound arrogant because it is not saying there's still an openness to religion being saving. It's saying religion cannot save. Religion is killed by whatever Jesus did on the cross. That's exactly what Mark argues, Peter Bolt says, one of my lecturers. When the temple curtain was torn in two, it's not simply saying something better has come. It's saying no religion will ever, can ever, has ever worked. In fact, guys, brothers and sisters, Christianity cannot afford to be unsure of that which God has already proclaimed fully in the life and death of the Son. When you are neutral about Christianity in comparisons over the dinner table with Islam, etc., you are not presenting Christianity truthfully. You have to present Christianity as, in fact, the only way, the only thing. And you must also present the negative, which will get you thrown in jail, probably in some cases. Because you cannot say, Buddhism can save, but Christianity is a bit better. Because this is what I'm hearing your evangelical friends saying. And they are actually attacking this church for it. Because we do not say that. I've actually heard this formulated for me. That what your evangelical friends are saying, which is why they are against you in this church, is we should not say other religions are wrong. Well, what am I reading then in the scriptures? That other religions are right? They would say you cannot say other religions are wrong. You cannot say other religions are faulty. You just have to say Christianity is like a bit better and has maybe, you know, God's more personal and loves us more. Well, that's disingenuous. That's like telling me when we go to prom together, your dress is quite okay. And then later, I'm criticized in a Tatler or something or by a school magazine, and you're like, yeah, I knew that. I'm like, you didn't tell me. You didn't tell me. I have no sense of color. You know I'm colorblind. You didn't tell me. No, I wanted to tell you, but, you know, I don't want to hurt you. So I didn't want to say that what you're wearing is just so dog ugly that nobody will come near you the whole night. And what I was wearing was clearly the best, and she had followed me shopping. But since I have taste and you don't, I just thought we kind of just let you down gently and tell you that you look okay. I just am a little bit better. You're not a little bit better. You make me look terrible. If I need help and you don't give me that help when I'm dying, you are cruel and you do not practice your own religion faithfully. So Christians, you have to choose jail or being Christian. Wait. Not going to jail. Okay, you get it. Christ has been sent to be the high priest of his people and thus saves them. calls us to speak not just well of what He has done, but to speak poorly of what fails. Look, if God, who gave us the temple and the covenants, and Paul can praise it as the glory in the adoption and the covenants and the will of God, if God Himself can call those things useless and ineffective, then what do you think He would like you to use as adjectives for Muhammad and his creation, for Buddhism? You just think about that. And then the second thing I want you to think about is whether you should trust these Christian leaders who are saying, do not talk badly about any of these religions. Don't listen to false prophets. Do not listen to the incredibly traitorous message that Christians in Klang Valley are sometimes guilty of saying, like, all religions are the same. The simple fact is there's only one temple which God has specifically revealed for use, and that temple was not even designed to be finally and fully effective, and renders, therefore, all other religions and temples completely even more useless. Jeremiah, in fact, prophesied of the bigger problem, which was our own need for mercy from God, and only in Christ do we see that we have that fulfilled in the unique Christ King, priest-king from the order of Melchizedek. Hebrews 9:13-15, I commend you to read that. Hebrews 9:13-15, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without blemish, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Verse 14. If your friends want to serve God, there's only one way, and the path is through the cross. If there's only one Christ in human history, therefore, then there can be no religion that saves outside of Christ Himself. The question, my dear friends, is simply, do you have Christ as your high priest? Not, what good things can your religion teach you? The question is simply, do you have Christ as your high priest? Not, how many miracles have happened in your temple? The question is simply, do you have Christ as your high priest? Not, what does your religion teach you about the meaning of life? Or how does your religion teach you to be happy? The question is, do you have Christ as your high priest? That is the question that underlies all questions of religion. Do you have Christ as a high priest? I don't even care whether you're monistic or polytheistic, or whether your understanding of sin will be resolved through moksha or through samsara or dukkha. I don't care whether you have meditative methods, etc. I only have one single question which God teaches us to ask. Who is your high priest? Because without that, everything else is just conversation. The bottom line is, who is your high priest? The bottom line, the question of do you have the Christ as your high priest is not simply a philosophical question or simply a matter of religious inquiry or even spiritual experience. It is a question of how God can ever accept us, God can ever forgive us and let us live, when in fact with Israel, time after time after time, it is clear beyond doubt that He crushed His own people in the desert. He killed them time after time after time in their own homes. Even nearly during the Exodus, He killed them in their palaces when they were king's sons. He killed them righteously because mercy belongs to our God and is only given to us in the atoning sacrifice of the high priest. If He does that to His own precious people, the Jews, what do you think He will do to the pagan who has refused to call Him by name? What do you think? Do you have the Christ as your high priest? Without the high priest of the order of Melchizedek, whose name is Jesus, there will only ever be left death and judgment for Homo sapiens. Christianity is not about religion. It's as simple as a seatbelt. As it is appointed for man to die once, after that will come judgment. My dear friends, I'm going to be praying with you very soon. I beg you to avail yourself of this freeing quality of the word that's just been preached to you. It says in Hebrews 4:12-14, in a way that shows us God reveals judgment for our salvation. The word of God is living and active. It will pierce you. It will expose you. And it will expose you to the reality of the high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. You want to hold fast this confession? First, you must acknowledge how you have been exposed in your failure. Do you have this high priest? I'm going to conclude now, but I'll pray very soon. Please prepare your hearts if you want to become a Christian tonight to follow this high priest. But everybody, in terms of God, we have seen that the great religions of self-realization, including Buddhism, ultimately are seeking for God in a monistic framework where it could be this God or that God, it could be all gods, it could be any God, it could be unknown God. If these gods even exist, though, Greek philosophy teaches us that ultimately it means they are still part of the same universal conundrum. They are still part of the same framework. They themselves are elements of the ideal. They themselves are functioning elements within the larger scheme of things. They themselves need to become Buddhists. When I look at Zeus and his family, they have a lot of dukkha. Buddha needs to preach to them because they're very rotten and upset. The Viking gods especially. They drink a lot. They murder a lot. I wish we could get Buddha to meet them and chant some sutras together and get them to calm down a little bit and chat and think. All this killing is bad for your reincarnation, man, your karma. You see, everyone's just working out different ends of solutions from their own patch. So there is no real ultimate revelation of God. But then Jesus Christ comes into this world revealing to us God Himself. And what a sight! It was not a God who was muscular like Thor, Chris Hemsworth, or Loki, sneaky. I have no idea why you girls like him. It was a God who shows His wonderful love for righteousness, love for His people, His demonstration of service, died for us. He was not an impressive man. He was simply very righteous, very much God Himself come to earth. Here is the clarity that the Old Testament gives us of the high priest who is divine king in His cross work and resurrection. He is not monistically caught up in our mess. He can look at us with loving eyes and still be transcendent above us when we try to kill Him. He can say, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing," and take upon Himself our judgment. He's able to solve us from above by actually suffering for us as high priest. He is like us, but unlike us. He goes before us, ahead of us, for us. What a God. What a God who shows us the truth about ourselves. This is a realistic and working solution. The religions of fate, they revere this impersonal reality behind even gods and men. And then they create this pressure to conform to either a method to get out or a method to just keep conforming to expectations. But ultimately, it is all oppressive and doesn't solve the biggest problem which sin causes us to face up with, which is death. In the end, no matter how many times you fail and get recycled in rebirth, the reality is you still fail, which means sin continues. You don't change. How will you deal with this sin in real terms? I didn't speak about this before, but one of the things I've started to understand about Confucianism, Taoism, Chinese religion, is that in this oppressive atmosphere of needing to conform to a societal ideal for harmony, which in the end is self-imposed by the community, what mommy and daddy wants, expressed finally and fully in face. "You caused us to lose face, son, when you didn't marry her. We need to get those exams passed for the scholars' exams." What I've come to understand is that, as some scholars see it, there is an unhealthy failure that leads to taking life into our own hands. When we decide that we can determine arbitrarily, in a lower standard, but an oppressive standard for what it is that we think is right or wrong, in the end, just like bullying in school, it leads us to depression and suicide. And for generations, thousands of Chinese people living in this system felt unable to express who they were, as well as deal with their sin and the problems at the same time. Of course, no one is righteous. But the Chinese approach to solving problems by just not talking about it, for the sake of face, we put up with the abuse in the family. For the sake of face, we make sure daughter keeps quiet about how daddy visits her at night in bed. For the sake of face, we marry him off or her off to that much older man or that person in the other village. For the sake of face, even though you want to be an artist, we force you to be a scholar. For the sake of face, we do 100 different things on the basis of just an expectation of harmony, which in the end is simply organized sin. In a way that Buddha would call just all our desires manifesting in society in supposed harmony. This fear has been immortalized in Chinese movies that we've all watched. The scholar committing suicide, becoming a ghost. I think you all know the movies I'm talking about. The lovers committing suicide together in a canyon, in a gorge in China. These are part of our supposedly illustrious past. And I'm sure there's a similarity to this in Hinduism as well. But this pressure to conform, which is external, is arbitrary. It is a fear that in the end affects us in a way that has no real solutions because it is not coming from an internal need to be like God. There is no real God here, and there's no real understanding and conception of sin, and there's no real solution to man and their struggles. Chaos also is not the answer. And in the end, if sin and law issues are monistic or fate-oriented, then the solutions will always be very superficial and fail to bring about true righteousness. The things of tools and methods have no way of changing a person internally, and sin remains. Sin and law then, once they are properly conceived in terms of Christ and his death, then we'll have a proper solution, a proper standard, and a proper holiness which requires constant and inner change that comes by the Spirit's work. Ultimately, all the solutions we have seen are based around self-perfection. And that's the worst bit of all these religions. They are ultimately about becoming divine by our own effort. Because the goal in the end is to perfect ourselves so that we can realize our own divinity, to realize our own Brahman, to hit the perfection of confusion, loyalty and faithfulness, to have the perfect face, to be in Nibbana, a state of perfection without any dukkha. But doing all this, there is no real grace or redemption from ourselves. And it makes a mockery of Christ, and it is also unrealistic of the truth of our struggle to even be righteous and to be fighting sin. All our projects of self-salvation, therefore, are bound to fail, and they only have an illusion of success. And I can attest to that from my own family. Religion, therefore, is most certainly not neutral. If anything, it does the worst thing possible. It covers up the sin even more. And in an environment where we've just had one MDB, where we are now learning month after month of how the previous government apparently covered up what they did further and further, we must appreciate that in the same way, as a metaphor, we must no longer avoid the truth that the Word causes us to be exposed to. You are a sinful person. You are and have been and will be a failure by God's standards. You may choose to be like Lee Kuan Yew and pretend that your Confucian society is good, but we Malaysians know Singaporeans are actually no better. since I've just started. Give me one more line on Singaporeans. Singaporeans complain a lot about Singaporeans. Ilona is going to a school in Australia where the moment I mention it to my cousin, who is our lawyer, she's like, "Ayo, that school, ah. Oh, the Singaporeans there are terrible." Now, this lawyer is a nice person. She's a Christian, but she's saying, it was reported to her, voracious Singaporeans will take your notes and keep it for themselves and avoid you having it because they want to be competitive. It's a top schooler. Now, that's us too. We just don't dare to do it. We just don't have the same pressures. Our island is not small enough. We have too much money. We can afford those 60 billion of it in 10 years. No problems, can make more. We got a lot of, we can tanam jagong, anything, man. They got tanam nothing. They got nothing. They only have themselves and their notes. They have to steal. Okay? We don't have to steal. We can steal from ourselves and still be okay. 33,000 ringgit only, ma. Each baby is born with Malaysia. Make back in 10 years, no problems. Of course, I'm speaking in jest. But you have to realize that when it comes to the high stakes of salvation, religion fails. Because you are a failure. That is why Jesus died and is potentially your high priest. Stop this project of self-salvation. You're only lying to yourself, ultimately. At least be an atheist after tonight. In a way, at least recognize what I'm saying, that the Bible is saying. You can't go from this to religion. That's ridiculous. At least atheism is a religion which pretends not to be a religion better than other religions. Atheism is also a religion. It's a religion of no religion. But don't be an atheist. Why don't you stand halfway? Just face up to the fact that you are the sinner and he's the high priest. Humble yourself, pray to God for this humility and this clarity, and embrace God's gift of the Spirit, who, as Peter says in Acts 2, will cause you to repent and be baptized, and you receive him, and then you will know the Christ and what he has done fully. Let me pray now for you, to lead you, so that you may become a disciple of Jesus Christ along these lines. And if you're not going to do it, I hope that you will think very carefully as we are praying. Let's pray together. I'm going to pray on your to lead you, so I'll be praying in the first person singular. Lord, I'm really sorry for all this time I've been using religion as a shield. I've just not known very much about it. And even the things I struggled with, I just pretended it was adequate for my needs. And I was also using it to get what I wanted. Ultimately, I'm sorry that I have treated you and your son in this way. I know it's not respectful of his work. I know it's a failure to recognize what's plainly stated in history and in your Bible. So thank you very much for opening my eyes tonight, for speaking to me powerfully in your word, for knocking some sense into me, for showing me how all my previous attempts in my religious life and my moral life were just band-aids, and they really don't work. So thank you for this gift of your Spirit, that I can begin to understand these things. I'm grateful, Lord, that you chose to forgive me, even though I really have no reason to deserve it. Thank you for Jesus being my high priest. Thank you so much that he went and offered himself for me. I'm really grateful that you did that. And I want to keep clinging on to this, keep being thankful for your relationship with me, for uniting yourself with me, for being my Savior. Sometimes I'm sure I'll be ungrateful. Please rebuke me and stop me from running away. But thank you so much tonight for Jesus' death, for his forgiveness, for achieving my clean conscience so I can be with you tonight and forever, that I can serve you. And I'm really feeling different about my relationship with you. I know that you are not a distant God who I didn't know my previous religion, but you're actually right here ruling me by your Son. I hear your words. I know who you are. I know what you've done. I look forward to being with you in the rest of my life. So help me now. Please teach me how to serve you. By your Spirit, please teach me how to read your Bible. Teach me how to love these people, my new family of Christians, my brothers and sisters, I guess. Teach me how to be like you to them. And also based on tonight, to also try to speak to my loved ones, my friends. They are all, many of them still stuck in, well, they don't know sometimes what they believe, but they also refuse to check it out and change. So I'm going to have to try to speak to them and try to explain things to them of what's happened to myself too. So please give me the strength, the courage, the understanding. But thank you again for making me one of your people. I'm really grateful. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.